With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Advisor Radio, broadcasting from Horse's Mouth headquarters in downtown New York City. I'm Horse's Mouth senior editor, Ed Klink. We're here on the finale of Advisor Fest 2009. Today's show is brought to you by Vanguard. Vanguard's low-cost ETFs can form a strong foundation to help you meet your clients' goals. This morning, we'll be speaking with Sean Green on how to work the phone in a downturn. And later in the program, we'll learn how to get a handle on depression, anxiety, and rejection with Dr. Arthur Sierra McCauley. Then we'll talk about core principles for success, plus we'll have the winner of the cartoon caption contest. Joining me is producer Doug Pierce. Doug's the fellow you'll talk to when you call in with a question. Let's take a quick moment to explain how Advisor Radio works. You can hear our show live two ways. First, you can listen streaming through your computer. The second is to listen directly over the phone by calling 347-215-7291. If you have a question or comment for any of our guests today, just call that same number and press number 1 to indicate you want to ask a question. Doug will come on at that point and he'll take it from there. So that's how it works. Once again, our number is 347-215-7291. Joining us on the line from California is Sean Green. Sean is a sales and customer service trainer and the author of I'd Rather Have a Root Canal Than Do Cold Calling and a featured expert on Horse's Mouth's wildly popular Cold Calling Script Clinic discussion. Hi, Sean.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Good. How are you doing out in the San Francisco area there?
It is a beautiful, beautiful day, so probably can't help but do great today.
Good. Well, today, yeah, we have a nice day here downtown New York City.
Good.
Looking out at a nice, calm Hudson River, and we are going to talk about cold calling.
All right.
Well, you had a presentation here for Advisor Fest the other day. You presented a webinar, I'd rather have a root canal than do cold calling. We went over a bunch of great tips and strategies, and we thought we'd do a little recap today for listeners of Advisor Radio.
Sounds good. So to recap, what we did was talk about what creates the desire to do anything but pick up the phone and call,
mm-hmm.
which I call the root canal effect. By the way, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound good.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. Although there are certainly some people who have emotional issues that get in the way of cold calling, for most of us it's probably much more straightforward. It's our experience in getting calls at home that became so annoying that they created the Do Not Call law. So then we took a look at, well, what is it about those calls that is so annoying? And the list is, you know, you interrupt, you babble on, you sound very canned, you can be downright pushy, really assumptive, all that kind of stuff. The answer is to flip it over, make a consultative style call, which is pretty much the kind of call you would want to receive because your own preferences are what your prospects will prefer also. The way you want to do that is be very direct in asking for their time and telling people, you know, here's why I'm calling. That's easier said than done because we're so used to being obtuse, and many people find it challenging to get into the swing of how to say why you're calling in really, really direct language. And also people have trouble asking for that next step very clearly. When you don't ask for that next step, that that sales conversation step. When you don't ask for that clearly, you can start creating all kinds of problems for yourself, because when you do meet with somebody, you don't really know whether you're in a sales situation or not. So you can start things off on the right foot in the cold call, and when you add to it the idea of using your own regular language the way you normally talk when you're feeling comfortable and confident at work, then those things will nicely conspire together to help you make much more compelling calls and to feel far more comfortable at the same time. And what we did was we walked through examples of what not to do and then how to fix it. We could do a little of that if you want, or maybe people would call in. I should also mention that the Cold Calling Script Clinic has hundreds of examples, specifically for financial advisors and planners, of people saying, well, how about this, and getting a critique and getting compliments. So there's lots to compare there. We also talked about voicemail. One of the things we didn't talk about, I don't think, I have to be honest and say I don't remember, was whether to leave voicemail or not. Do you remember if we talked about that, Ed?
Yes, I think you said that you prefer, because it's a free, like, verbal postcard that you get to leave.
Yeah. I think that unless you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of calls to make, the best way to go is to definitely leave a voicemail, because it's a marketing opportunity. And if you think of it in your mind as dropping a postcard in the mail, only that's a verbal postcard, it's the same idea. It's a marketing opportunity. And your voicemail, in a lot of ways, just lines up just like a postcard. Go ahead.
I think the one reason that people don't like to leave the voicemail is, let's say I'm calling you, and you don't answer, but I get your voicemail, and I leave a message. Hi, I'm Ed Klink, wondering if you'd like to be on Advisor Radio. Mm-hmm. You don't call me back. I sort of feel rejection. I try calling again, leave another message. You still don't call me back. Now I've been rejected, and I feel like I don't have the chance to actually talk to you in person. So instead, if I just keep calling until I get you, I don't experience any rejection, because you're just not home the way I see it, until I finally get you on the phone. So what do you think about that?
Well, this only happens to you, Ed, if we know it's you calling. It's probably why. There are a few things I want to comment on. Most people, when they make a call and they get voicemail, if they choose not to leave voicemail, they still feel like that's a bad call. And for anyone listening who recognizes, oh, yeah, that's how I think of it, well, if you don't leave voicemail, then you're reinforcing the idea that every time you get voicemail, that's a bad or failed call. That is going to help to create frustration, and it's also unreasonable in terms of expectations. Whenever you're doing marketing, whether you're putting something in the mail or leaving voicemail, or just making calls, period, know what's reasonable to expect. What's reasonable to expect when you're making cold calls is you'll get a lot of voicemail. When you leave voicemail, and you leave a voicemail that's properly constructed with a call to action and clearly saying, here's why I'm calling, your response rate, in general, on average over time, that's the caveat, is going to be pretty much the same as it is for direct mail, 1-3%. So a philosophy you might want to use is always leave voicemail, never expect them to call you back, be ready when they do.
That's good.
I would also recommend that people choose a guideline for how many times they're going to leave voicemail before they put it on a back burner. And just for the heck of it, I suggest a guideline anywhere from 3 calls to 5. It could be more. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing more, but less probably won't be very effective, because the other thing to keep in mind about marketing, including telemarketing, is that it's repetition and consistency and persistency that puts luck on your side. So let's say your guideline is 3. You're going to try to reach a prospect 3 times. On your 3rd call, if you get voicemail again, leave voicemail, but go ahead and tell them you're going to put them on a back burner. Because if you don't say anything and you just stop calling, there are lots of prospects who will notice that. And then when you call them way down the road, you know, a few months down the road, they will be less inclined to talk with you. So your third voicemail would sound something like this. I'm going to play financial advisor, so forgive me if I don't do that very well. This is Sean with ABC Investments, 510-237-8323. Love to see if our services might be a good fit for you and your family. I'm looking at my notes here. I see this is my third call. I'm guessing this isn't right at the top of your to-do list right now. I'll be checking in with you down the road. Feel free to give me a call as well. Sean, 510-237-8323. So did you notice how I said, hey, I see I've called you a bunch of times and now I'm going to call like down the road, and I was really vague about it?
Okay.
That's going to make it easier for me to manage. I don't have to tell people, I won't call you for 3 months, and then I have to make sure I do that in 3 months, which is kind of a pain in the butt. But still, I'm telling the prospect, hey, here's why I'm calling, still call me back. But because there's no particular call to action in that third voicemail, my expectations for calls back should be a little lower. A call to action would be, please call me back. But because I'm telling people, hey, I'm guessing this isn't at the top of your list, if I say, please call me back if you're interested, then that's kind of a wishy-washy call to action anyway. When you use a guideline, that also helps you avoid prejudging prospects, which is something people often do that also gets them into trouble. Like I'll think to myself, oh, wow, this company over here, I bet the owner is really successful, has a pot of money to work with. I really, really want to work with that company. Oh, but that company over there that I drove by, they don't look so hot. Well, when we do that, when we're prejudging prospects, we're really doing something very, very inappropriate for prospecting. When you're prospecting, when you're marketing, you really know very, very little about your prospects. I don't care how much information you have on lists or what you might see on their company website or something like that. You really don't have very much information. So if you prejudge and then the company you really thought of was a hot prospect, they don't even want to talk with you, then you're going to get more frustrated. So by using a guideline and applying it pretty much across the board, I mean, it's a guideline, you don't want to be totally strict about it, but when you apply that guideline, you're going to prevent prejudging, and that will help you really approach every prospect as they are and qualify them throughout the whole process. End of lecture.
Good. We're on Advisor Radio with Sean Green, author of I'd Rather Have a Root Canal Than Do Cold Calling. And we'd like to hear the script that you're using. We can go over it with you right here on the phone. Call us up at 347-215-7291, 347-215-7291, and press 1, and we'll get you on the line. And yeah, folks who aren't calling in have some form of call reluctance, don't they, Sean?
Or maybe they're busy or all set.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a couple other things that might be useful to listeners. This radio show, our topic is sort of calling in a tough market and challenging economy. One of the things, I wrote an article about that's on Horse's Mouth somewhere. One of the things that we should all expect is that prospects will have more doubt and more sort of suspicion, especially of strangers, cold callers, than normally. That might turn around a teeny tiny bit now because the markets are perking up a little bit, but still, it would be a good idea to expect more doubt, more objections, and be ready for it. So when you're calling, you want to marshal your energies, focus your energies on your best opportunities. That's counterintuitive for a lot of people in this line of work because they tend to be very goal-oriented, and the goal that they have in mind is way down the road, new business. When someone raises a lot of objections, that seems like a really great hairy challenge, and they want to sink their teeth into it and try to overcome objection after objection after objection, that's going to tire you out, and it's also going to piss off a lot of prospects. So be prepared to handle objections, and be prepared to let go and just ask if you can call back.
And we've talked here at Advisor Fest and on Advisor Radio, one of the themes is that it really is a great opportunity. There's a prospecting opportunity here, amid all of the rejection and the uncertainty and the people who are being a little bit, more jaded, there is opportunity. And it's a matter of crafting the right script and going after the right people to be able to grab that opportunity.
Yes. And so one of the perspective that I'm about to espouse here runs contrary to other perspectives. So it's a good contrast. People can pick and choose, experiment, figure out what works best for them. The way you decide who are the right prospects, who are the right ones to pursue, is not fully in advance of the call. That's prejudging the prospects. Pick and choose all throughout the process. So when you're prospecting, what you're looking for is A, people who are willing to hear you out. So someone who won't talk with you at all is not a good challenge. They're NAP, not a prospect. The next thing you're looking for is people who are open to exploring that fit between your products and services and what they want and need. If someone's just not open to it, just ask to call back down the road, because they might be open later. But don't push it too hard, because they're just going to push back. You're a stranger barging into their space on the phone. That's only going to be natural. You want to marshal your energies for those opportunities. When you do get that opportunity to explore the fit, when you do get that opportunity to have that sales dialogue, conversation process, then continue to ask questions and ask yourself internally, how's this fit looking on my side? Do you think you'd like working with them? Do you have the right products and services? Are they open? Those kinds of things. So to step forward a little bit and look at the sales process, it's important to ask people to talk about the reasons behind a statement. So, for example, you're in the sales process. You say, so, do you have an advisor now? And they say, oh, yeah, I work with my brother-in-law. And the advisor in the sales conversation thinks, oh, darn. I was going to say something worse. Oh, darn, this means they'll never change. Well, you don't know that. They might hate their brother-in-law. They might be really sorry they're working with him. So if somebody says something like, oh, yeah, I've been with my advisor for 20 years, or it's my brother-in-law, or I think they're great, then give yourself a chance to find out really what's behind that statement by asking, tell me more about that, instead of prejudging it. If we roll this truck back to the prospecting side, when someone raises an objection like, oh, I'm happy with my advisor, then in order to deal with that, you have to think about, well, why might they want to talk with me anyways? And the reasons usually boil down to a comparison, just in case, just in case something happens with their current advisor, or that the services might complement. So put one of those out there and see if the prospect's open to it. And that's your best bet. And then if the prospect says no again, I really recommend you just stop at that point and ask if it's okay if you call back down the road. That way you're throwing these prospects back into the bucket of prospects, and that's what's going to work for you.
Now, at what point, Sean, are they considered, in your mind, not a prospect?
They're NAP, not a prospect, if they won't talk with you.
And when you say that, if someone says, look, I got to go mow the lawn, sorry, my kids are running around, I can't talk.
Oh, no, I just call back. I mean, if they're being a jerk, or they say, don't ever call me again.
Okay.
Yeah. People who aren't open to change, and they say, oh, I think it's a really bad idea to change. I think everyone in financial services is a snake, that kind of stuff. NAP, not a prospect. Someone who raises objection after objection after objection after objection when you're on a cold call with them, NAP, not a prospect. Not so much because they probably aren't really open, but because they're a pain in the butt to sell to.
And
I
think
would like to run screaming away.
One thing we talked about too is, you know, when you're making these calls and it can really, you know, wear you down, is to think that when the people respond that way, if they're hostile in some cases, in many cases it has nothing to do with the call. There's something else going on in their world that you don't know about, and you just happen to be the one there who's taking the heat.
You are so right. And that brings up also the idea of listening for their tone to see if they seem open or interested or excited. You don't want to do that either. You're like 2 minutes out of their day, week, month, life, and you have interrupted them. They're not thinking about what you're calling them about, probably. Very, very few people will be. That would be an amazing coincidence. So don't let their tone of voice drive what you do and say. That's why putting a good script together in advance and sticking to it is so useful. And when you put your scripts together, have your script be focused on what you will say, not dependent on what prospects say and do, except for asking permission. Does that make any sense? Let me see if I can explain it a little better.
Yeah, if we give a sample script, that would be good.
Okay, well, I'm waving my hands around. Doesn't that work? So you say, this is Sean, ABC Investments. I'd like to see if my services might be right for you. Do you have a few minutes? They say, okay. And then if I say, do you have an advisor right now? And then my script has a, if yes, say that. If no, say this. And then the next part is, how are things going with your investments? If they're bad, say this. If they're good, say that. Well, all of those questions, when I'm asking prospects questions, what happens next is under their control. It's dependent on them. And what when we create scripts like this, we're doing that because, A, we think we can predict what people will say, and probably without realizing it, we think we can make people do stuff. And neither of those are true, because humans are just chock full of variety. It works far better if, instead of asking prospects questions and then responding that way, we go first with information. So it would go like this. This is Sean, ABC Investments. I'd like to tell you a little bit about how I approach advising and then see if you might be open to meeting to talk business. Do you have a minute? When the people say yes, and only when they say yes, then I'm going to talk about how do I approach business instead of asking them questions. So I'm offering them information. So I'll say, well, you know, I've been in the business for 25 years. I've seen lots of ups and downs. In fact, I came in during a last pretty serious recession. Here's how I approach things with clients. Everyone's a little different, blah, blah, blah. And you really want to paint a picture of how you work with that and show off your personality, your philosophy, that kind of thing. And stay away from, so tell me about your broker or advisor, or tell me about your family. And definitely stay away from questions like, how much do you have in investments or how much do you have in savings? Gee, have you thought about how much money you're going to need when you retire? I mean, oh, my goodness. Those are scary questions for anybody. And when a stranger asks those questions, your prospects aren't likely to answer.
Yeah. I notice in your script you say, do you have a few minutes? You don't ask, is this a good time for you? Is there a distinction between the two?
It's just my style. I mean, either of those work. So here are some examples of asking permission. Do you have a few minutes? Is this a good time? Now, I personally wouldn't say, is this a good time for you? But that's just because I don't talk that way.
I'm also thinking it reminds me that I have so much to do. So, you know, is this a good time? I would think, you know what? No, it's not, actually, now that you've brought that up.
If you roll that concept backwards, what you're saying is, gee, I don't want to open the door for somebody saying no. I don't want to remind them that they're busy. Therefore, I'm going to ever so slightly manipulate them into saying yes. That's what you're saying.
Right. Or another way is, am I catching you at a bad time?
Yeah, but wait, stop right there.
Okay.
So if you think you can make people do stuff, if you can manipulate them into saying yes or no, you're wrong. Now, it's not like you're trying to steal something from them. It's certainly a benign, teeny tiny little manipulation. But it doesn't work very well. And if you're trying to just in a little bit manipulate people now, then most of your prospects will recognize that at some level and start pushing back. In order to do much better with cold calling and selling, for that matter, learn to say very clearly what you would like and learn to be okay with the prospect saying yes or no, because you can't make them not say yes or no.
Well, this is good, because I think a lot of us, we do have this, I think you mentioned, kind of obtuse way of going about it, and we might be slightly manipulative even though we don't realize it.
Yeah.
I think another example you gave, we have to unlearn what we've learned.
Yes.
Doug, who said that? Who said that? Anyway, the one example you gave was...
Freud said that.
I think it was Yoda.
Yoda.
In one of the sample scripts you put, we often say, the reason for my call is I would like to provide a complimentary portfolio review.
Yeah.
And you say what are your comments on that? The reason for my call is we'd like to provide a complimentary...
The reason for my call is... Nobody says that in real life unless we're in trouble. The reason I've called you into my office is we're laying you off. The reason for is completely canned, scripted, not what you would normally say unless you were nervous. So the way to unlearn a habit is to replace it with something else. And now I'm going to get all like psych major on you, so hold on, bear with me. We used to believe that people feel a certain way or people act a certain way because they feel a certain way. Neuroscientists, psychiatrists, emotional health professionals, more and more studies show that people feel a certain way because they act a certain way. What this means is we can act as if in order to change how we feel about it. The way this relates to cold calling is we can act as if we feel comfortable, and then we will end up feeling comfortable. We really will feel comfortable. And the way you act as if you feel comfortable in a cold call is you use your own regular, everyday, at-work language. And your own everyday, regular, at-work language when you're feeling comfortable does not include the phrase, the reason for my call is. The way you would get rid of that is if you have that in your script, print it out, or if you like hand wrote it, amazingly you did the old-fashioned handwriting thing, what you want to do is have that phrase in front of you and literally take a pen or pencil and draw a line through it, cross it out, and see what you've got after that. Or if that doesn't work, if you have a partner as you're calling or as you're practicing, every time you say that phrase, let your partner just sort of gently whack you on your head. You have to recognize, oh shoot, I said it, and then you have to replace it. And unfortunately with a verbal habit like that, the thing to replace it with is to just not say it.
Hmm.
Yeah. So let's take an example. The reason for my call today is I'd like to see if our services might be a good fit for you and your family. Well, if you just take out the reason for my call today is, then the rest of that sentence works. I'd like to see if our services might be right for you and your family. It will feel weird and awkward at first to say things this way. The reason it feels awkward and uncomfortable is not because you're not doing it right. It's because it's something new. You're actually building those new neural connections in your brain. It will just take a while to feel comfortable. Same thing happens when, I don't know, you change your golf grip, or even you move stuff from one drawer in the kitchen to another drawer in the kitchen. Or you have a new car. Or, Ed, I'm sure you can relate to this, you have a new purse. And you got stuff from different places.
No, it hasn't happened yet. But
oh man, okay.
I could see the power of habits, though, for sure.
Yeah.
And we do say things. You know, we often don't know why we say them.
Yeah.
We just
and
do.
Sometimes we just do. I have a friend from France who points out that Americans say something's interesting when we don't want to say something bad about it.
Hmm.
We do. In the U.S., we do use obtuse language a lot. And it just takes practice to learn how to say things right out. The script clinic, I'll put a plug for my book, working with me, all of those things help you actually recognize, oh, this isn't very direct, and then see, here's how I would say it to be direct. It just takes practice. And so going back to this idea of when you're trying new stuff, whether it's things that I'm suggesting or things other people are suggesting, when it feels weird or uncomfortable, don't let that make you stop. Give yourself time to get used to it and then decide. You really want to give it a good solid test drive, see how it feels for you, see how it works in your market, and then decide whether it's working for you or not.
We've got Sean Green, author of I'd Rather Have a Root Canal Than Do Cold Calling, on the line. If you'd like to ask a question, share your script. You got a question about how your script is working for you, some challenges that you're running into, call us up, 347-215-7291, 347-215-7291, and press 1, and we'll get you on the line. Now, your book, I'd Rather Have a Root Canal Than Do Cold Calling, your title is really based on the idea that there's this real pain of making calls. What is the source of that, and is it rational?
Is it rational? Yeah. Because it's based on our experience in getting calls. The source of that phrase comes from the first telemarketing workshop I ever gave. And it's in the introduction to the book, but I'll describe something that isn't in the book. The first telemarketing workshop I ever gave was many, many years ago. It was for a call center of a bank in California, a pretty big bank. I won't mention it. But it's a bank that still exists. Anyways, they had a call center of about between 80, 100, 120 service reps who were taking inbound calls. And the particular department or product group of this bank was not doing well, and they decided to all of a sudden have these service reps make outbound calls to existing bank customers. But still, they went from, oh, I took this job to make to handle service calls inbound to I have to make cold calls. And 2 days before the workshop, every single supervisor quit. So there was a little stress going on in this group. And I walked in to the workshop where, you know, I was there in the workshop setting up. People started coming on in, and I could tell they were not happy to be there. And it was my first telemarketing workshop, but it wasn't my first time I had to deal with that kind of stuff. So I started asking people, you know, how do you really feel about cold calling? And the first few people gave me basically a BS answer. And then like the third or fourth guy just looked at me and said, I'd rather have a root canal. And I think that's the perfect description of how a lot of us feel, despite what our dentist might say.
Yeah. Well, we went through some great tips on your webinar by the same name that we had the other day on AdvisorFest, and the replay is available till the end of this month. You go on the Horse's Mouth main page, click on AdvisorFest, you can hear the whole thing. I noticed that we talked about gatekeepers a lot in the webinar, and we could circle back around to that this morning. But you do give some tips that we didn't mention about dealing with inhuman operators when you call a business and there's a phone system that's automated.
Yeah.
And these are just, you know, ubiquitous at this point, wherever you call, you're going to get an automated system with rare occasions. And you know some tricks to get through that, to get the person you want to talk to. Let's say there's a certain business person, executive that you want to get to. Can you share that with us?
Sure. If you don't know their extension, first of all, start with the gatekeeper option where if they allow you to talk to the receptionist, who's your gatekeeper, and just ask for their help and to getting through to them. If the receptionist says something like, well, I'm not allowed to give you their direct phone number, respect that, because you might get the receptionist in big trouble if you manage to persuade them otherwise. When you can't talk to a receptionist or operator type person, excuse me, try pressing zero anyways. That might get you to a person in the organization. And again, just ask for their help. Whenever somebody picks up the phone and it's not the person you're calling for, you can use the gatekeeper script. Tell them why you're calling the company or the person. Be very forthright about it and ask for their help. And then be quiet and let them respond. Also, if you call after hours, after 5, a lot of times a human will pick up. You can try a combination of numbers to get to a person. You can try calling the sales department, which is often the easiest group to find. And again, you just tell them, I'm trying to reach so-and-so, or I'm trying to figure out who I should reach. Would you help me? Can you suggest, or can you share their phone number or something like that? And that's how you do it. But this is a good example of an AP, not a prospect. If you can't find the person, you just can't get through to them, then don't call them. Mm-hmm. Use a different marketing tool to try and get through.
And what do you do when you get the gatekeeper and they ask, and what is this in reference to?
You tell them. So it would be, we have some terrific services for employer-sponsored retirement plans. I'd like to see if those services might be a good fit for your company at some point. I'd like to figure out who I could talk to about that. Would you help me out? Would you give me a suggestion?
And as we talked about on the webinar, to avoid little tricks that people often use, such as sending in a letter to the person, and then calling up and telling the gatekeeper, oh, I'm following up on a letter that I sent.
Yeah, I'm following up on a letter, because that letter has magical properties and it's going to pave the way for everything. Yeah, you don't want to do that. If you play games with gatekeepers or you play games with prospects, most often you're going to lose, and it takes an awful lot of energy. I mean, really, most people in this line of work are not into playing games. And so if you find yourself thinking, well, I'm going to have to schmooze or play games, it's just going to take you out of powerfully using who you are as a person and as a profession. I know that's very Berkeley, but hopefully people know what I mean. Let's talk a little bit about keeping your energy up, especially through the summer doldrums.
Okay, Ed.
So summertime, a lot of people have vacation. So you can expect to get more voicemail. Be ready for it. Have that expectation because it may indeed happen, and that will help avoid frustration. And when you're leaving voicemail, you might have some fun by leaving a tip or a little tidbit, some kind of morsel of information, bit of trivia from history.com or something, or a quote at the end of your voicemail. That really can put some style and fun into your voicemail and often increases your response rate. For that matter, if you're permitted on your outgoing voicemail, why not do the same thing? Provide a tip or a quote or something like that. I mean, we know you're either on the phone or away from your desk. It's really so lame at this point to say that. And if you need to say, please don't leave any trade information, well, you can still do that and leave a tip. Some systems, even like when people are calling in and they get your voicemail, some systems will allow you to skip the rest of the message, so you can just say that. After this is a little quote of the week. Feel free to skip it by pressing pound now, that kind of thing. So all those things will help keep your energy up. Also, while you're calling, if you set a dials goal, that will help focus you on what you have control over. And it will also give you a marker of success that for a lot of people is missing. Like for a lot of people, well, here's the real obvious marker of success, new business, right? And then if you go backwards in time, the marker of success in front of new business is what? What's your guess?
In what respect?
Well, how do you know you're doing well? You've got new business. You know you're doing well when you get new clients. In front of that, in terms of time or process, the next way you know you're doing well is appointments. You go, oh, yeah, I have 10 appointments. Yay, that's a success marker.
Okay.
Well, when you're cold calling, you need a success marker before that. For a lot of people, that marker is missing. So the dials goal gives you that marker and also helps focus you on where you are in the process, which is going to help you do better in general. So set a dials goal. Count all the calls you make, no matter whether you get a fax screech or it's just a wrong number or you left voicemail, whatever. Count every single one of them. Set a goal that you can hit. Set one that's reasonable. If you have a stretch goal, it's going to demotivate most people. As you make calls, let's say your goal is 25 dials, because you want to do something you can pretty much do in one sitting. As you call, make little marks on a piece of paper. That will physically tell you you're making progress, and that's really helpful too. And then after your 25th call, even if it's like a really, really exciting call and it's inspiring you to make more calls, don't. After that 25th call, stop and take a little reward, something you can do right then, right at work that takes like 5, 10, 15 minutes. It's this time of year, it's still pretty nice. You could take a walk, maybe go get an iced coffee. My reward is I'll usually call my sister and yak for a little while or something like that. What that system does, using a dials goal, marking things off, then stopping after you hit your goal and taking a reward, that teaches you the productive, correct habits for success with cold calling. It also teaches you to keep going when you're having a bad calling session, when nobody's saying yes and all you get is voicemail, that kind of thing. And those correct habits are what's going to help drive your success.
Hey, Sean, it's Doug here.
Hi, Doug.
Hi. I'm wondering if you had any experience with, on the topic of motivation, accountability groups, enlisting sort of friends and make a little game of it to see who can make the most calls or...
That's a good thing to ask about. Accountability groups are really, really helpful. I wouldn't make a game of who can make the most calls because everyone's goal, everyone's dials goal is going to be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do as a group, even if you're not in the same area physically, is you can tell each other, here's my goal, here's what I'm calling, and then make an agreement of how you're going to check in. When, let's say you and I are calling buddies, Doug.
Okay.
And you tell me, let's say you're having a really hard time following through. So our agreement is I'm going to call you after you're probably done with your calling session. I'll mark in my calendar when your session is. I'm going to call you. Here's what I should be asking you. What was your goal? How many calls did you make? Which should match. And then, Doug, if you start saying, oh, well, yeah, I made those calls, but, then my job as your accountability person and buddy is to stop you and say, no buts, you made the calls, good, and leave it at that. And that's also going to help drive those productive habits of making the calls. It's making the calls that is going to get you comfortable, and of course it's making the calls that's going to give you lots of opportunities to reach the right people at the right time. When you have somebody else holding you accountable and also focusing you on what you should be looking at, it really is helpful. Now I had been making cold calls for quite a while before I had my first really, really good sales manager, but what made him really, really good was he held all of his salespeople to task. And it was that experience that quantified and clarified for me what happens when you make enough calls to reach enough people, to have enough appointments, to have enough new business. So that's a good idea. Now, you can also use your calling buddy to help you with scripting because, Doug, if you and I got to know each other and I listened to your script, then I could say, Doug, you don't talk like that. Or this doesn't show off your personality, and I could nudge you and help you and cajole and nag you to help you put that personality out there. And that's part of what makes cold calling very powerful also, is that we can so much leverage who we are on the phone, that when you do that in your scripting and your calls, it helps a lot.
Good.
Question.
Well, thanks, Doug.
Yep.
And, Sean, we have Frank on the line.
Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
You sound great.
Okay. My question is, when you get past the point, you say, is this an okay time? And he says yes. How long should the next section of your call be, or how brief should it be?
Oh, that's another good question. A couple things I want to ask you something. Frank, are you going to also ask the prospect questions? Are you planning to qualify?
A little bit, yes.
A little bit. Okay. So the first guideline I recommend is you always want to talk longer than you expect the prospect to talk.
Okay.
The length of time, instead of thinking of a length of time, what I would do is script out kind of what you think you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure it's written the way you talk. So
right.
Shorter sentences, periods, commas, all that kind of stuff. If you're worried it's going to be too long, is that what you're thinking about?
Yes.
That it would be too long?
Right.
Thoughts, time it, because when I've had people do this before, most of these calls are 2 minutes or less. It's kind of like
okay.
Call time. It's way less. It's not nearly as long as you think it is. But ultimately, what you want to do is go ahead and test drive the calls. And if people start interrupting you or saying, oh, I'm sorry, I have to go or whatever, then yeah, you know it's too long.
Okay.
Yeah, but chances are it's probably not as long as you think.
Okay.
Frank, do you mind being our guinea pig for qualifying questions?
Sure.
You're a brave guy. Yay, Frank. So share with
What's
us.
What's the worst that can happen?
Pardon?
What's the worst that can happen?
There you go. So share with us the qualifying questions you think you want to ask.
Okay, and before I do that, I should say that I have not made a cold call in 20 years. And so I'm
great guinea pig.
Yes, so I'm thinking through this on my own just after listening to the webinar the other day.
Okay.
But the main
hold that thought for just a sec.
Okay.
So you're bringing up something that a lot of people are experiencing because of, are you a financial advisor or a planner or something
yes.
like that?
Yes.
Okay. So people in this industry, let's just put this out there. If you've been in the business for many years, you're probably having to market more than you have in a long time.
Correct.
And so for a lot of people, we would have spent years of, I'm going to say we, even though this doesn't apply to me, we would have spent years saying, oh, I get all my business to referrals. Yeah, I get all my business by sitting back and eating bonbons. No, not that bad. So for people who have not made calls in a long time, that can feel like, oh, gee, something must be wrong with me. Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. I'm going to go eat worms kind of thing. Recognize that when your marketplace goes through a downturn, then the more proactive direct marketing tools are the ones that work best. And cold calling just happens to be one of them. So you're not a horrible person. This isn't you're not a bad advisor or anything like that. Okay.
Okay.
Now, questions.
Okay, the main qualifier, and I'm not sure exactly yet how I'm going to word this, but something like, if you like the services that we offer, we generally require a minimum account size of $100,000. And without getting too personal, asking you how much money you have, I would just simply ask, is that something that would be a possibility for you?
Okay, well, that's pretty good, actually. Yay, Frank. Yay!
Good.
Well done. Here are some options to consider. When you're in the part of your script where you describe your practice or your approach,
right.
What you might talk about is that dollar figure, as in, we generally work with clients who have $100,000 and up to work with.
Okay.
When you mention that in your description, you can...
By doing it by doing it then he's not even going to set the appointment, and if he doesn't already meet that?
Probably not. You know, every now and then you'll get some wacko that didn't get it or wants to mess with you or something like that. I shouldn't say that if they don't get it, they're wacko. But some. But even I mean, that happens anyways, that you go out and meet with people and, gee, it doesn't turn out they have 100,000. I would also recommend that you, I don't know how to say this tactfully, don't say stuff like investable assets, because, like, what the heck does that mean to the average person? I don't know what that means.
Okay.
So it's like $100,000 to work with. You might say including savings. A lot of people forget that savings is an investment, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
The other option for asking a really, really personal question is you ask permission to ask this question. So you'd finish your little description. You go first with information. That'll pave the way. And then you'd say something like that. So that's a little bit about me. You may know that most advisors work with people who have a certain amount to work with. I'd like to ask you some general questions about that. Is that okay? And then if they don't want to, they can say no right then, and you can respect that. You can also use a range where you can say in the neighborhood of 100,000, say IRA, savings, other kinds of things, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you, Frank. That was going to be very useful for a lot of people.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Frank. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Right, if you have a question for Sean Green, call us up, 347-215-7291, 347-215-7291. Press 1 and we'll get you on. Wow, 20 years since he's last made a cold call.
That's true for a lot of people, a lot of people. I have had the really useful experience of working in markets that had just experienced a downturn. Like I took a job selling to investment bankers after the so-called crash of, what, 87 or something?
Mm-hmm.
And their budgets were cut in half and stuff. It's a good thing I didn't know that when I took the job, or I just would have been terrified. Once you've reminded yourself what it's like to proactively market and really hit the streets and work hard, I think it helps your confidence in general. This is also a time where financial advisors and planners in particular can be so helpful to everybody. When you're calling, let's say, you know, Frank was brave enough to tell us his qualifying number. That's a common number. What do you do when the prospect says, oh, no, I don't have it even close to that? Or maybe they get mad and say, well, I used to have that, but I don't anymore. One of the things you might do is have a person you can refer to. Like maybe you have a colleague who's working with smaller size portfolios. So you'd say something like this. Oh, well, you know, I have a colleague, Doug, who might be a great advisor for you to consider. Can I introduce you? That kind of thing. Or you can say thanks but no thanks, but still offer to help in some way, which getting on my soapbox here, I think would be a good thing for everybody to do. It's good karma. You say, oh, well, I don't think we'd necessarily be a good fit working together, but you've been so kind in giving me your time. Is there a question, an issue that maybe I could help you with here on the phone, and give them that chance? So what you're doing there is you're networking, and that's only going to help.
Well, and another benefit to that approach, Sean, is that many times people don't realize what they have. Many people don't think that they have money. You know, it's the whole like blue collar millionaire thing where a person says, you know, you're not looking for me. You know, you must be after some high roller. And meanwhile, that person, you know, owns a couple businesses in town. And maybe they don't have a whole bunch of cash on them or ready to invest, but they might have other money or assets elsewhere that are kind of sitting around that they haven't figured out what to do with and don't fully understand what it is that you can offer to them based on that quick call and just say, oh, you know, I don't, just thinking of their IRA, that how it's dropped, you know, in value. No, I don't have that, you know, that level to meet your minimum. But meanwhile, they have a business that they're going to be selling in 6 months that never even comes up in the conversation.
That's a good point, where they have friends and family. There's all kinds of reasons. Also, someone who hasn't prospected in a long time or someone who's really new to the business might also not have been in the situation where they've done much selling for quite a long time, where they might be brand new to it. So there's a lot of value in not qualifying at all and just asking everybody for the opportunity to talk with them, because that's going to at least get you practice.
Yeah, that's it. And it's a matter of you're just getting back out and doing it. And the one thing here at Horse's Mouth, I mean, we talk about a variety of prospecting approaches. And cold calling has always sometimes generated different opinions about it. But it keeps coming back, either that it's effective, it works, it's borne out by our discussions with financial advisors, interviews, research we've done, and also the discussion, you know, that you're involved with, the cold calling script clinic. I saw there was some activity just the other day where people are posting their scripts, and that's a great resource, but it's still very viable. All you need is the phone, you spend a little time on your script and a list, and you can work right there from your desk.
Yeah, you're good to go. Do you mind if I comment on the whole, is cold calling worth it or not?
Sure.
Thank you. I knew you'd say yes. That's why I asked. most people in business development need 2 to 3 marketing tools in play at any given time to have the greatest success. And what those tools are, you know, mail, networking, cold calling, warm calling, whatever you want to call it, what those tools are will vary depending on your marketplace, how much budget you have, your own preference. And looping back to the idea of marketplace, your marketplace changes over time. So whenever your marketplace kind of contracts or gets less open, that happened recently in a big way. It happened in California when the Silicon bubble burst. All of a sudden, a lot of people who hadn't had to work very hard at prospecting, who had just been doing networking or even having lots of people coming to them, had to use more direct methods. Those more direct methods are picking up the phone and the mail. Networking is a fun thing to do. It can be an incredible time and money suck. It can take a long time to roll. And I also want to point out that when you say, oh, referrals and networking is a really good tool to use, I would bet that the way you're getting those referrals is you're picking up the phone and asking your clients for a meeting. That's called telemarketing. Or if you're networking, the way networking really pays off is developing excellent relationships with the people you meet networking. The way most people do that is they pick up the phone and they say, hey, let's meet for coffee. Hey, let's exchange some business information. Every time you pick up the phone, you're telemarketing. And whether you call it cold calling or warm calling or what, it's all telemarketing. And the approach and the scripts and the expectations, all of those things still apply. But ultimately, no matter what's going on with the market, no matter what your colleagues or I might tell you, ultimately, each person has to see how it works in their market, see how it works for them. So try not to let the shoulds get the better of you. Give it a good, solid test drive. Make some awesome mistakes. You know, keep what works and just dump the rest.
So instead of just looking at it as cold calling, it's really a tool that's used overall in a variety of approaches as part of your overall strategy.
Exactly. It's telemarketing. Whether it's cold, warm, whatever, when you pick up the phone, that's using the phone as a marketing tool.
Gotcha.
Period. Yeah.
How about if someone, when you mentioned there about referrals, using the phone for referrals, let's say I talk to Doug, and I'm talking to him kind of go through the referral process, and he says that I should give you a call, that you could benefit from my services. Mm-hmm. Can I call you? And let's say I get the gatekeeper, what are you calling for, Mr. Klink? Oh, you know, I was referred by a friend of Sean Green's to call her. Is that okay? Now, you're not expecting that, and Doug did actually tell me that he thinks it would be okay to call, but does that work?
Yes and no. I would. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear that. There's a helicopter flying over.
No.
It's very loud. I think that it'll probably work best if I'm talking to you and you give me a referral. If I ask you, A, can I use your name? And B, would you introduce me?
Mm-hmm.
But let's say I can't use your name or I forgot to ask you and I'm too embarrassed to call back. Call you back and ask, hey, can I use your name? I still think it's best to say, Ed Klink suggested I give her a call. I'd like to talk about our services and see if they might be right for her at some point. Both of those things are true. If you leave one, if you leave the here's why I'm calling out, then you're not really being forthright. And that runs the risk of annoying your client, or prospect rather. It runs the risk of annoying your client. It runs the risk of getting the person on the phone in trouble, which will come back to haunt you. And it also runs the risk of what happens when you don't say out loud something you know to be true. When you keep stuff like that unsaid, it just sits like a lump in your gut, and that little lump adds to all the other little lumps about cold calling, and next thing you know, you don't want to pick up the phone.
Gotcha.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the book is I'd Rather Have a Root Canal Than Do Cold Calling. Author is Sean Green. And as I mentioned before, you can catch the replay of the webinar that we had and go to the Horse's Mouth main page, click on the Advisor Fest link, and you can hear the webinar until the end of the month. You can also check out the book, I'd Rather Have a Root Canal Than Do Cold Calling, on Amazon. And there are a number of resources written by Sean Green on the Horse's Mouth website. You can also visit her on her website at savageandgreen.com, savageandgreen.com, and her email is sean@savageandgreen.com, S-H-A-W-N. I want to thank you for joining us today, Sean.
It's a pleasure. Before we go, I want to mention that Amazon has an error on it. It currently says the book takes 1 to 2 months to ship. That's
mm-hmm.
not true.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's ready to go, and it's in its second edition.
Yeah.
We got both copies right here.
Cool.
Good.
Chock full of examples just for financial advisors and planners.
Yes, I noticed that.
Yeah.
Well,
thanks for having me on, Ed. This was fun.
Thanks, Sean. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
All right. Coming up in a minute, we'll learn how to get a handle on depression, anxiety, and rejection with Dr. Arthur Sierra McCauley. We'll be back in 1 minute, here on Advisor Radio. Back on Advisor Radio. I'm Ed Klink. We're broadcasting from downtown New York City. Today's show is brought to you by Vanguard. Vanguard's low-cost ETFs can form a strong foundation to help you meet your clients' goals. Coming up later on Advisor Fest at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, we'll have Staying Positive Month After Month, Breaking Through the Inertia with Jim Rohrbach and Bill Smith. And then at 4 o'clock, How to Structure Your Day During an All-Hands-on-Deck Era with Steve Sandusky. You can register for those on the Horse's Mouth main page. Click on Advisor Fest. Our next guest is Dr. Arthur Sierra McCauley, a licensed clinical psychologist with over 30 years' experience heading psychology departments and directing alternative medicine facilities. He's a member of the Harvard Medical School faculty, where he is instructor of psychology. He's the author of a number of books, including Performance Addiction and the upcoming The Curse of the Capable. He's also written The Power of Empathy, Treatment of Abuse and Addiction, A Holistic Approach, and co-author of Beyond the Influence, Understanding and Defeating Alcoholism. We'd like to welcome Dr. Arthur to the program.
Hi, Ed. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Good. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, we had a comment from a financial advisor that I just wanted to start off the program with, where he said, "Nobody gives you a playbook on how to react when the market goes up, let alone when it goes down and keeps going down."
Mm-hmm.
So just using that as our starting point for advisors out there who feel like, you know, they've kind of gotten blindsided, hit, and trying to figure out what to do next. I know this is really one of your areas of expertise, as well as the whole idea of being a top performer and then suddenly realizing that the rug has been pulled out from under you.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go? What are you seeing with your clients when it comes to this?
Well, interestingly, Ed, I just came from one of my group sessions, my coaching sessions, and with 10 corporate people, and four of them financial advisors, two of them brokers and so forth, and we were actually talking about that very subject. So what we've learned and what I've learned over the years is that, of course, when it's a day at the beach, most people can perform well. When things go down, as in this last in this continuing economic downturn, it really tests our sense of self, our belief in ourselves. So when we're getting constant positive feedback, it's easy to keep our sense of self afloat, our own view of ourselves. But when things start to go down, and, you know, of course, a number of my clients who are financial advisors, people are complaining, some people are very critical, some people really personalize their loss of income and blame. And you really have to have a very resilient sense of self and essentially a resilient lifestyle to maintain your own view of yourself in the face of this negativity.
So what are you seeing that advisors are not doing?
I think one thing that, you know, many advisors don't have healthy lifestyles. I'm not saying everybody, but it's very common because, I mean, that's part of what The Curse of the Capable is about, my upcoming book, is that most advisors are intelligent, educated, capable, hard-driving people. But what they don't always realize is that their lifestyle does not support a downturn in the economy. So if you're not maintaining nutrition, getting enough sleep, exercising regularly, maintaining positive relationships, you're not in a position to cope with the downturn. You know, you're already depleted, exhausted. You're probably a little bit overweight, and you might have high blood pressure, high cholesterol. I see these kinds of symptoms in people's lifestyle, so that when things turn sour, you're not in a position to cope because you don't have much left in the tank.
Yeah, it seems that people we're talking to, in many cases, they're just treading water, you know, just trying to keep their head above water, and they'll worry about those other things. You know what? I'll change my diet. I'll start exercising later. I know I should be doing it. I'll patch up that relationship, you know, in a few months. I just got to survive right now.
Right.
What are some steps for someone who's in that situation right now could start?
To take inventory and realize that things are going to get better. We're already seeing signs of things recovering, but you have to have a healthy lifestyle to maintain yourself throughout the years. I mean, a lot of financial advisors in their 30s and 40s may have 20, 30 years to work, and you have to take inventory about how you live your life. It's never going to be okay to just achieve in business. You have to be achieving in those other important areas, those five other areas: exercise, nutrition, sleep, intimate relationships, so that when you're back in the game, you're in a state of mind that allows you to cope with stress. And recognize that now. So start to make some changes in your lifestyle. Don't be glued to the computer all weekend long. Start to exercise. Start to talk about some of the stress that you're experiencing with people close to you. Start to, you know, realize that you need more sleep. Maybe plan a vacation in the summer. Start to do the things that relax our neurochemistry and put us in a position to cope better. And realize what you haven't been doing that allows this whole situation to be worse for you.
And one of those areas is also advisors who've seen their own bank accounts take a hit. So here they are, trying to advise others, but yet suddenly they've got their own mounting financial pressures.
And we see the psychological impact of lost revenue, because some people have bought into the myth that the more money they make, the more happy they're going to be, and they're going to be able to stabilize their sense of self. And it's a myth. I mean, more money is not correlated with more happiness. I mean, if that were the case, the United States, the richest country in the civilized world, we'd have the highest rates of happiness and lowest rates of stress and depression, diabetes, and obesity, but we don't. So it's great to make money. I mean, it makes sense to help people make money. It helps us to live our livelihood and live a higher quality of life. But if you're obsessing about it, if you believe it is the thing that's going to make you feel better and have other people respect you, you're really misguided. And now it's time to take stock of that myth and put it in perspective in the first place.
That's true. That's a good point. How about handling guilt over poor portfolio performance?
Well, again, I think, you know, the difference in a person's self-esteem has something to do with when you factor in situational variables versus personal variables. If you've done something in your work or in your helping other people and you're setting up their portfolios and you legitimately believe you've made mistakes, then try to learn from them. Be a proactive learner and learn. We're all learning through this experience. On the other hand, some of this is situational. Look, the greatest minds in the country, right? I mean, you see on national TV on a daily basis, people are interviewing leading economists from Ivy League schools and leading financial advisors, people who've been successful throughout their careers, and they all made mistakes. So there's a situational variable here that's not personal. And in order to maintain your sense of self in times like this, you have to be able to differentiate between what's personal, I made a mistake, I really misguided you, versus a situational variable that's no different than getting hit by a car. I mean, you didn't plan to get hit by a car today. It happens. It's a negative circumstance, but it's not produced by your incapability. I think we have to make separations between those two dynamics.
Well, now, advisors often have strong ego drives, and they're mm-hmm. individualists. And when a person like that comes across situations that make them feel like a failure, they could easily become depressed, but there's often a resistance to outside help. Why is that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think, and people have actually asked me recently, do you see more men in your practice now? I mean, I've seen more men in my practice, especially in the corporate world, in the last decade than I see women, actually. So especially with this concept of coaching, I think, you know, sometimes I kind of smile because when I do some corporate lecturing, a client of mine will introduce me as a coach, and I've actually don't generally refer to myself as a coach. I'm a clinical psychologist, but I think it's made the corporate world see it as more palatable. That, you know, we are all vulnerable at times. If you get carried away with trying to perfect yourself and thinking that people won't accept your imperfections or your vulnerabilities, then you can't ask for help. I mean, and what wise person, what intelligent person who sustains a career of success doesn't ask for help? So I think pride interferes, ego interferes, and we need to get past that because, look, we need consultants in our lives. And someone like myself, if your mood is down and it's been persistently down, then go and learn why. I mean, find out from someone who's been through this with other people and helped other people, especially someone who's helped high achievers. Find out what makes you so vulnerable so quickly when things are not going well. It's important, very important to have that information.
How do you know when there's a difference between you're just feeling down, you got the blues, you'll bounce back versus, you know what, maybe there really is a problem here or something going on?
Well, Ed, we all have days where things aren't going well, and I mean days or hours, but depression, especially clinically depression, doesn't lift. It's not like you have a bad Friday and then you have a good weekend and your mood picks up and you're back in gear on Monday. When you're clinically depressed, it doesn't lift, which means that your neurochemical balance is really off. And then it's very hard to maneuver up from that position, and that's probably the time when you need to consult with someone. And I'd encourage people not to just consult with someone to get medication, but to talk with someone, because it often doesn't take very long to help, for someone to help you put your life in perspective. you know, we're all very subjective. So if you're hiding your vulnerability, you kind of swim in your own head with the same story over and over again. And until you get feedback from somebody who's being more objective outside of you, you can't really see the forest for the trees. So depression is when it lasts. If your mood is lasting, if you're down Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the weekend, and Monday comes and you're feeling worse, then you're really in a position where you probably can't help yourself, that you need some outside feedback, some outside input. And that's what depression is. It doesn't lift. It's not sort of the typical moods that go up and down in our life on a daily basis. And, you know, you might have a good hour, and then the next hour you might have an interaction with a client where you don't feel so well. It lasts. It lasts. You get up in the morning, you feel worse, you're dragging during the day, your energy is low, and particularly you start to say a lot of negative things to yourself. There's a lot of internal name-calling.
Hmm. Yeah, that is a big part of it, right? When you're the thoughts that you have and what you're saying to yourself, that makes a big impact.
Yes, when your self-voice becomes punitive, you know you're in trouble. You know, I always try to help people have an understanding self-voice, meaning that we shouldn't let ourselves off the hook again in terms of what we were talking about earlier. If you've made a mistake with a client and you need to consult with another one of your colleagues to understand where you went wrong and how you were misguided, that's fine. But if you're personalizing every negative circumstance, you start to become more and more critical with yourself, and that drives your mood down. The other thing is, you know, our self-voice, the way we talk to ourselves, was determined a long time ago, much before this recent recession. So you want to go back in time and learn, you know, what is the way I tend to talk to myself? And a lot of high achievers will give themselves praise when they're performing on a very high level with consistency, but the minute they make a mistake, they start to think of themselves as a mistake. You know, it becomes all-encompassing, and that's what really lowers your mood because, you know, it's sort of like a good professional athlete. I treat some professional athletes in the area, and the real good athletes, when they make a mistake, they study the mistake, and they're interested in it. They're in a learning process. So they're what I call proactive learners. People who tend to have a negative self-voice, when they make a mistake, they really start to feel like they are a mistake. They can't forgive themselves. They can't get past it. And in the conversation with the next client, they're not there anymore. They're not hearing. They're not focused. They're not present because they can't let go of that error that they made. And that's something that's established early in life. That tendency is established early in life.
Hmm. That comes from early coaches, family, friends?
Yes, family, parents. We all write an early story about ourselves. And what I try to teach people is that story that we carry around in ourselves is not reversed just because we become very capable, just because we're achieving on high levels. I mean, I see people consistently that achieve on very high levels in their career paths, and yet when things go wrong, their mood goes down pretty drastically. So that initial story that we had, that we wrote about ourselves, is fiction. And as adults, we have to make that a nonfiction book. We have to rewrite it, we have to edit it, and find out what the truth about ourselves is. And we only find out the truth through the feedback we get from other people, positive and negative.
We're on with Dr. Arthur Sierra McCauley, author of Performance Addiction and the upcoming The Curse of the Capable. If you have a question, feel free to call us, 347-215-7291, 347-215-7291, and press 1, and we'll get you on the line. Maybe we could just briefly clarify, what is the difference or the interaction between depression and anxiety?
Well, you know, anxiety is also, there's a range, Ed, just as there is with a low mood when you move up to the range to depression. I mean, anxiety is not all bad. You might feel anxious before you are going to interact with a very important client. You might feel anxious before a tennis match that you're really going to enjoy. When anxiety becomes excessive, it means that it's not really in relation to a current event that seems to make sense, you know, because anxious people, they tend to be anxious when they're at the beach, just the same way as they're anxious when they're at work. It doesn't lift very much. The difference between anxiety and depression is anxious people are not necessarily criticizing themselves. They're more focused on the outcome of the interaction they're having with someone. So it isn't necessarily that their mood is low, but they're kind of hyperactive inside themselves. They're not relaxed. They don't feel comfortable in their own skin. So there's a distinction there between being uneasy and being tense versus self-criticism, very punitive self-voice, which tends more to be more characteristic of depression.
And what can you do to take steps to free yourself from that?
Well, again, twofold. One is to try to differentiate between situational variables and personal variables, as we discussed earlier, and also realizing that if you are chronically an anxious person, it's not something that has to do with your present situation. Something in the present may be accenting it, but it means that you probably have been anxious for a very long time, and you need to look back and, again, find out what in that old story about yourself makes you anxious. For instance, high achievers often are anxious people because they're often looking at the scoreboard. You know, they're scoreboard watchers, so they're looking to see how they're performing. And if they're performing well, the anxiety goes down. If they have a day where they're not performing well, the anxiety goes up. So their anxiety is always correlated to the outcome of their day or the outcome of an interaction with a particular client. And that makes it very difficult because, again, you're not factoring in that you can't always get good results. I mean, especially in this economy. I mean, you know from your work and interviewing the people that you do, what people are going through today, you're not getting that positive feedback consistently. But some people aren't thinking as a regard in relation to it. Their anxiety is not overwhelming. But people who have been anxious by nature, that their old story about themselves says that if I don't perform very well, I'm not worth very much, their anxiety is inordinate. So it's connecting the past to the present, because that anxiety you're experiencing today is not just about today. If it's consistent, it's also about yesterday.
And the anxiety and the depression can be heightened by increased rejection.
Yes, yes. And again, in a good market, financial advisors are getting a lot of positive reinforcement. That's not the norm today. I mean, I know from my clients that it's changing a bit recently, but you're getting a lot of negative feedback on a consistent basis. So what does that mean? You need to turn to the other aspects of your lifestyle to make up the balance, the exercise, nutrition, sleep, and being with people that you have intimate relationships with where you feel valued for who you are, not just what you do. You know, when you're advising people financially, you're being rewarded for a positive outcome. I mean, people may not at times be very interested in you personally. So go to the people who are interested in you personally and who care about you, may even love you for who you are, your character, not just for your performance. You have to have that balance in your life to cope with that consistent rejection, especially in a down market.
Good. Well, my producer, Doug, here has indicated that he has a couple of questions that have come in.
Yep. One of them is, what are some warning signs that an advisor needs to take some steps to deal with their anxiety and stress?
Well, one thing is that, again, it's the persistency of it. The warning signs would be that it doesn't lift. If you have a bad interaction or a meeting with a client that just doesn't go well, it's normal to feel somewhat down, I mean, to be disappointed. But if that anxiety, that low mood persists, and you're still obsessing about that client that you had on Monday, and it's Friday, then you know that there's something else going on. There's something historical going on inside you. That's what I mean by, you know, the present is often tying into the past. If a person's sense of self is stable, you have a negative interaction with the client on Monday, that should be gone by Tuesday afternoon. I mean, if it involved significant amounts of money, of course, you might be still thinking about it. You might be strategizing with a partner or a colleague about how to improve that situation or how to get back to that person with a different strategic plan. But if you're persistent about the negativity of it, what they said to you, how you disappointed them, I can't believe I failed, all that punitive negative self-talk, if that's consistent throughout the week regarding that interaction that was 3-4 days ago, something historical is getting stirred up in you. That old story about yourself that was probably negative is getting stirred up in you. And that's when you really need to talk to someone else. And I don't always mean a psychologist or a coach. It could be a good friend. It could be your wife, your girlfriend, your husband, your boyfriend. Somebody that you know is not just going to placate you, but would give you objective, clear feedback.
Good.
And another question was, can you suggest any daily healthy mental routines or habits for advisors to incorporate into their lives?
Well, I think one thing is that, you know, and I know this is an old cliche, but you do need to count your blessings, don't we? I mean, we want to try to establish an attitude of gratitude in life. And when you have an attitude of gratitude in life, you're not just focusing on the negative aspects. You're looking at the whole of your life. When you're under pressure, and certainly financial advisors are under great pressure in these economic times, you tend to have a very narrow focus. The more stressed you get, the more stress hormones you release, cortisol and adrenaline in your brain. When you get stressed and you get anxious, those stress hormones make your vision very narrow. It's sort of like you lose that wide lens camera to a very narrow tunnel view, and you don't see the whole of your life. That's why conversations with other people who know you, who are close to you, can help you put your life in perspective. For instance, you know, I talked to advisors. I was one of the fellows in group this morning, the coaching group, was talking about, you know, how disappointed he is, and you know, people started. Some of the women asked him about how is his marriage. Well, the marriage is great. I was divorced 4 years ago. Now my current wife is a wonderful woman. He talked about the positive relationship he has with his kids. It's Father's Day coming up. They're taking him, you know, out to eat at his favorite restaurant. And you know, one of the guys said, you know, you got a pretty good life. I know business is off, but it helped that individual who had tunnel vision in that moment when we started this conversation. It helped him see the whole of his life. When we're stressed, when we're worried about our performance, when clients are giving you negative feedback, you can lose a more comprehensive view of yourself. And that's when you need to turn to people outside of yourself, people close to you who know you, who focus on the other aspects of who you are to give you a more balanced view, and that will lift anxiety.
Good. And how about for individuals who, okay, business is off and they want to look at the whole of the picture, but you also have people who are, say, falling in that sandwich generation where they've got to take care of kids and now they've got to take care of older parents, so situations at home may not even be a respite.
Yes.
For them.
Well, I mean, that's obviously very difficult because, for instance, some of my clients, I mean, their wife or their husband is in the corporate world too, and they're not getting good results either, and their productivity is off, and their clients are complaining. So they've got a couple of young kids. They're coming home. Both parents are tired and depleted, and there isn't enough to give to each other. So, yeah, it becomes very difficult. And if you have an aging parent or a parent in a nursing home, or it seems like life is just obligated. You're leading an obligated life. And, again, what do? You have to have some novelty. You have to break the pattern. You have to, you know, a night out, or you're going to a concert, or I know you don't have energy, but go to the gym and get a workout in. Think of the good things that will elicit some of those positive neurochemicals in your brain that start to lift your mood. So if you can't turn to your spouse, if you're both depleted, one of you watches the kids and the other goes to the gym, or the other takes a walk, or the other goes out with a girlfriend for lunch, or you go out with a guy friend of yours for a jog, you have to have some plan. You have to have some structure. Because what happens with two people working, especially in the corporate world, you're so depleted by Friday night that there's no plan for the weekend. People end up hanging around, feeling like they're just leading an obligated life. It's Groundhog Day over and over again, and the weekends are not replenishing. So I try to encourage people, make a plan. Have a plan to do something. Even though at the moment you don't feel like you have the energy for it, it will boost your energy. Do something you like to do. Break the cycle. Don't just hang around and sit around on the sofa and complain to each other.
That's true. In addition to a plan for the weekend, what about the importance of a plan looking forward 6 months, a year, 2 years out? Does that help you give a focus?
Well, I think it helps. It helps to have goals, not only professionally but personally. You know, what's your goal for the summer? Where do you want to go on vacation? What's your goal for the fall? I mean, we were talking this morning about people saying, "Oh, it's rain." You know, we're in New England. It's been raining for days. Can't get out and exercise. The winter is going to be. You know, they're complaining. You know, because the mood was negative this morning, so then people start to talk. Well, it's cold and snowy here in the winter. Well, one guy said, you know, I took up cross country skiing last year with my wife, and we'd get out on a Saturday. That was a good thing. And again, starting to think outside of the box, just like you do when you're making a plan for a client. You everybody's different that you're interacting with, and you're trying to strategize and be creative. You have to be that way in your personal life too. So having a goal, not just professionally, but having a goal personally, what's going to make me happier? What's going to make me more fulfilled? you know, what is it in the future that would lift my spirits? What's there to look forward to?
And now your book, Performance Addiction, really talks about that. It's about sabotaging the balance that we should have. And that's because we've got such a focus on succeeding or getting ahead.
Yes, I mean, performance addiction is the belief that perfecting appearance and achieving status is going to secure love, respect, and happiness. And it's an irrational belief system, and it's hardwired from early experiences, and again, it's reinforced by cultural expectations. So we grow up thinking, especially capable people, we think that if we keep performing, keep achieving, we're going to have love in our life and respect. And if we make more money, we're going to, you know, the unconscious desire for making more and more money, sometimes money we don't even need, is that it's going to bring us more love. It's going to bring us more adoration from others. And it is mythical. I mean, on the surface it does, but your true friends who really know you and love you and care about you, I mean, they don't just want to be around you for how well you help structure their stock portfolio. I mean, that gets rather old and boring after a while.
Why is it that I guess in our society, someone who's in a modest home driving a 10-year-old car that's paid off versus someone else who's in a McMansion with a couple of Mercedes, but they may have payments on the Mercedes and they may have a huge mortgage, the second person is still seen as more successful than the first.
You know, it's part of the myth of our culture, Ed, and I want to accent that I'm all for high achievement. I mean, I'm all for capable people need to achieve. It's sort of like muscular people need to use their muscles. And I talk about that with people who are moving toward retirement, because I know some of my clients won't do well in retirement unless they're consulting or working part-time or maintaining some of their more interesting clients. So those of us that are high achievers, we like to achieve. We have abilities. We should actualize those abilities. But the belief that making more money or having the McMansion or having the Mercedes is going to somehow heal that internal wound inside us that we had from childhood, that old story about ourselves, it's never going to do that. You can't solve an internal problem with an external solution. And that's where part of the myth is. You know, you can tell with business owners, for instance, I work with a lot of CEOs, especially in small business. Some of these people just love their work. I mean, some people think they're just in it for the money. They're really not. They have enough money. They love the work. They love being in the process. They love using their minds. They love creating new strategies that are going to help their clients. You know, the money is a byproduct. It's a great thing. It allows them to have more freedom in life, but it's not the end all. They haven't bought into the fact that just the money or just the exterior things that you can attain is going to bring them that sense of happiness, because it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, it really is a myth that we have in our society. And our collective mood in this country is worsening despite 4 decades of becoming better off. I mean, in the final analysis, we should realize at this point that net worth does not equal self-worth.
And yet it still persists.
It still persists. And in order to be successful, in order to sustain a successful career, you have to understand and integrate this factual knowledge into your life, into your lifestyle, because you can succeed over a period of years if you have this in balance. And it's very difficult to have this in balance in our culture, because people all around you are saying, look, if you work, you know, 15 hours a day, that's great. I mean, I was kidding a friend of mine. He said, how do you know who has the curse of the capable? I said, well, you know, on a Monday morning when I see clients and I say, how was your weekend? They say, I got a lot done. I mean, they don't tell you about how they did something that's made them happy, or, gee, I went to a concert, or, gee, I went to my daughter's soccer game. It was a lot of fun. I got a lot done. Well, they worked all weekend.
Yeah,
you know, they're walking around with their BlackBerry and their iPhone, and you go to a soccer game, and they look like they're in a frenzy. I mean, I don't think they know the score of the game.
Yeah, I see that too. What is the role of that, of the technology and all that, playing into this, where you can be available all the time, so as a result, you know, you are, many people, I know people, you know, on weekends, you know, they have to get work done because, you know, their boss will send them, here, review this document, and they know that they have the BlackBerry, and they know they can see it. How do you get control, and can you set up parameters and say, look, I'm not available on Saturdays or Sundays?
Well, it's a tricky question, because it depends on who you work for, and I like to encourage people to realize that, you know, sometimes we have to overwork. I mean, that's part of the reality of our lives. I mean, when I'm publishing a book, I might have to work on a weekend. I mean, I have for many weekends in the last couple of years of writing The Curse of the Capable. But you try to think of it as time limited. There's an exception to the rule. There are times when we have to work more. There are times when something very important is coming up and we tend to have to overdo it. But you have to take inventory at the end of every week and see where you are. And sometimes you need other person's help to do that. Like a lot of people, when I interview couples, I'll say to someone, how many hours a week do you work? And they'll say, oh, 50, 60. And then she'll look and say, he works 80 or 90 hours. Or how many hours a week does she work? Oh, she'll say 40, he'll say 60. So there's a discrepancy there because when we're that driven, we lose track of how many hours we're working. And yet you do have to set limits. If you have a boss I have a client who his boss writes him, he writes emails at 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, and he'll call my guy at 10:30 at night and want to have a discussion. And it got to the point where he had to set a limit with him and said, you know, I can't maintain my marriage if you call me at 10 o'clock at night.
Right.
And if it's really a crisis, if it's something that is really making you anxious, I'll be glad to talk to you. But I think for both our well-being, we have to set some limits. And, you know, his boss accepted it. Now, I'm not saying everybody would, but there's a time where you have to draw a line for your own well-being and your own integrity and for the integrity of the close relationships in your life.
Now, where does sleep and sleep deprivation fall into all of this? Does it have an impact?
Well, yeah, it has a dramatic impact, Ed, because when you're sleep deprived, you know, you're waking up in the morning and you're imbalanced neurochemically so that you're not producing the neurochemicals that allow you to focus and be present. So then you're waking up with a higher level of anxiety because your body really wants to sleep longer. And the natural thing to do, people are, you know, stopping at Starbucks, getting the large coffee, throwing a bagel in the car. They don't have proper nutrition. Now they're sleep deprived, trying to get the caffeine to stimulate their brain. All it does, cups of coffee during the day is okay, but when you go over 3 or 4, you're fraying your nervous system. Your nervous system's already frayed because you're sleep deprived, and that's causing neurochemical damage. Now you're trying to either ingest, the natural thing when you're sleep deprived is to ingest simple sugars or caffeine. For some people, nicotine. So now you're trying to get the brain to run on something that really is not designed to help you, but is really going to ultimately fray your nervous system. So, of course, you're not focused and you can't perform as well. And people go on like this for years without even realizing that they would be far more productive and need to work less hours if, again, their lifestyle, their sleep patterns, and nutrition were in balance.
And somehow our culture has got across to us the idea that, you know, sleeping less, you know, you're seen as more productive. I mean, look back all the way to Benjamin Franklin. He had the famous quote, up, sluggard, there's time enough to sleep in the grave. And
right.
Thomas Edison slept 3 or 4, you know, hours a night because he was so wired with his latest invention. So
yeah.
I guess we kind of, you know, we learn from, we see these great people and we get these messages that, you know, if you want to achieve greatness, you get out of bed. What are you doing? Sleeping your life away.
Right.
But
and
there's a cost for that.
Yes, and It's you're giving interesting examples because if we examine the whole of their lives, how successful were they? In our culture, we tend to look at people in very narrow ways. If a professional athlete exceeds expectations, we think he's a wonderful person. If we have a celebrity who's a great singer, people project onto that person and think she has a wonderful life. So Edison, whoever achieved on a high level in one area, we don't know how it affected the other areas of their lives. If we look at a person's life comprehensively, the people we should have the highest respect for who are the people who are successful personally and professionally, and you can see in their eyes and their demeanor and how they look that they're healthy, they're vital, they're vibrant.
True. Well, a colleague of ours, Sean Bailey, our editor-in-chief here, has a question. Sean, are you on the line?
You're Hi, Ed.
Dr. Arthur?
Yes.
Yes. first of all, Dr. Sierra McCauley, I appreciate you being on our show.
my pleasure.
Two issues that I think I've heard most of the program. I had to step away for a minute or two, so I don't think you've covered this, though. Tell me if you have. Last fall, when the market collapsed, you know, in September, and you know, it was just terrible, you know, all through the fall and into the winter. We started to hear about suicides among advisors. I think there were at least five in the New York metropolitan area.
Yes.
Did you guys touch on this topic yet? No.
No.
Okay.
No.
So good. So this is you know, extremely important, I think. And
sure.
While we had access to you, I really wanted to spend a few minutes with you so you could address that. If there are advisors out there right now, well, you know the drill on this, but let's what can you say about this? How, you know, what people start to feel and how to go for help and all that sort of thing, and also other advisors listening who are concerned about advisors that they know. So, mm-hmm. What can you tell us?
Well, you know, it's a very, very critical question, extremely important question. So I'm really glad you asked. In fact, in one of my coaching sessions yesterday, one of the fellas who is a financial advisor, when he came to me about a year ago, had seriously thought of committing suicide. He actually was collecting pills, and long story short, he got to me, and one of the fellas in the group yesterday was talking about not intending to commit suicide. He said, but what really bothers me is I start thinking about it. I start thinking, if I just took a lot of pills and went to sleep, I could just get away from this. So I don't really want to die. I just want to get away from it. I don't want to talk to clients anymore. I just want to get some rest, some peace of mind. And we started to have this conversation. And then one of the fellas said to the person that he knew had been with us for a year, who had actually was collecting pills to take his own life, he said, well, what made the difference? And he said, you know what made the difference is being here, is talking to you all and exposing what I thought I would be rejected for and that I would find very humiliating to express. He said, when I first told people about it, I did feel humiliated. But being here and realizing that other people are in the same boat and realizing that what I was experiencing doesn't make me less of a person and reaching out for help and putting my life in perspective, that's what saved me. So long story short, what in that story is relevant for any advisor? Don't keep it to yourself. I know it's very hard when you're a high achiever, when you're used to performing on very high levels. You tend not to be the person that reaches out for help, but confide in someone. When you're having those kind of thoughts, share them with someone. Try to share them with somebody who's objective, somebody who's a good friend, somebody who you know will be confidential. May not be somebody you work with, but somebody outside of work, or somebody in your HR department, or a professional like myself, or your wife, or your husband, but somebody. The privacy of it makes your thinking get worse. You know, it's sort of like being in a bad neighborhood. If you stay in a bad neighborhood and you don't ask for directions, you drive around and you just drive around in circles. You have to come out of yourself and realize that it's not unusual to get to that point. Very, very capable people have thought about taking their lives. Very, very capable people lose their perspective. And when you get depressed, when you get down, as we were talking earlier, your thinking becomes very, very narrow. You keep producing stress hormones, cortisol and adrenaline, which don't allow you to produce the neurochemical serotonin, which makes you more relaxed and calm and more able to think reasonably. So I guarantee you, if you're thinking of suicide, your thinking has become very narrow, and your thinking has become distorted. You need to get outside input. If you try to do it yourself, the likelihood of it working is very low.
Okay, so that sets up my next question perfectly. To some degree, you know, I moved here to Manhattan 10 years ago, and you know the whole story about Manhattan. You know, half of Manhattan's in therapy, or the other half has been in therapy. You know, it's out there. This is a city of high-achieving people, and, you know, it's out there. People talk about it. It doesn't carry it really carries no stigma for the most part. But our audience comes from not just the New York metropolitan area, but the whole country. And in many parts of the country, the notion of going to see a shrink, you know, can carry with it a stigma. And I thought it would be good for us to talk about the therapeutic process, how it works, and what someone could expect, and how someone could be, what they might do to sort of open the door to talk to somebody in their community, and what to expect, basically.
You know, it's an excellent point too, because I know, I mean, people have this idea that you're going to go see a psychologist or a social worker, and you're going to, you know, sit in a chair, and you're going to tell them all about your life, and he or she is not going to be very interactive. Look, you, high achievers, I mean, that's why I wrote The Curse of the Capable, and on my web, we're just developing the website, www.thecurseofthecapable.com. I'm going to have a coaching corner there where we're going to have these kind of discussions. But you need to be with somebody who understands the market, understands economy, understands financial advisors, somebody who's more interactive, energetic, not somebody, look, you know, there's a lot of people in my field who are going to sit back and be very passive with you. That's not the person who's going to help you. Being in a coaching group or being talking to someone who you know, get a referral from somebody else who's seen this person. But you don't need to lay on a couch. It doesn't take 5 years. You want somebody who's proactive, who you can tell by just talking with them and being with them that they've walked the walk themselves,
right,
that you can see that they're healthy, that they're vibrant, and that they're going to give you feedback. One of the faults of my profession is people don't get enough feedback. I mean, I'm fairly interactive. I tell people, I'm not going to say something to you when I don't know anything, but when I know you well enough, I'll tell you what I think. And at the end of every session, I mean, I'll give you my opinion. I tell people in the first consultation, look, if you come here 4 or 5 times and you don't think it's working, you should fire me, because I don't think you should continue. You should have a sense that you're getting something here that you can't get from a friend or a colleague. If you can get this from a friend, there's no reason to pay me. There's no reason to take my time or your time. So you have to feel with that person that there's a fairly dynamic connection.
Right.
And I think a lot of high achievers have complained. And I see people have been to psychiatrists, psychologists, they've been on medication, they've been put on an antidepressant after they've been seen for 10 minutes, and they say, you know, this profession, it doesn't work. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about my mother and father. What I say is, look, I'm not interested in talking about the past unless it interferes with your present. And that's what I mean about in The Curse of the Capable. I tell, you know, I try to tell stories of high achievers who have rearranged that old story in their head, re-edited their book, and come out with a more vibrant sense of self. So you don't want to be with somebody who's going to wallow with you in the past or allow you to use it as an excuse. I'm not interested in anybody blaming anybody from the past. I want you to understand the past if it interferes with the present. If it doesn't interfere with your present, then we're not going to talk about the past. And you want someone who you get a sense is going to work with you that way.
I think, you know, those are excellent points, because certainly in talking with people over the years, you know, I've had friends who've, I went to this therapist and it just, you know, it didn't work, we didn't connect, or they just assumed that therapist was like all therapists, and therefore, because they didn't have a good connection, they just stopped trying. And I think it is important to emphasize that you do need to have a good match with a therapist, and that shopping around in a way in terms of getting recommendations and going and visiting with a therapist and see if it makes sense. You're absolutely right. Some are much more interactive than others, and finding the right style, both for the person who's going for the therapy and the therapist, is crucial. But some people don't even think that's even comes into play.
Oh yeah, I mean it's so very important. You're absolutely right. I mean, you wouldn't pick a financial advisor by going to the yellow pages, right?
Right.
I mean, you ask your lawyer, you ask your friends, you ask
absolutely.
Your accountant. You want some references. You want to know if it's no different than any other profession. You want a primary care physician. You don't pick up the yellow pages or just go to anybody who's in your insurance panel's list. You ask a friend. You ask a neighbor. You want some referral basis. So ask other financial advisors. Financial advisors are high achievers. They're people who are driven. They're people who are very capable. You need to feel like you're with somebody who understands that, not somebody who's very passive or, you know, you can tell is very low key, doesn't have a lot of energy, doesn't understand the market or the economy, not interested in it,
right.
And is going to wallow with you and always directing you to talk about the past over and over again, and you're not getting anywhere.
Right.
You should have a sense in that first consultation that something's going to happen.
Right. Right.
How about employee assistance programs? Would an advisor start with that?
Well, employee assistance programs are tend to be very good because they have a track record. Like the ones in I consult to a number in the Boston area, because what they do is, you know, they might see you for one or two meetings, and then they refer you to someone. But then they track. The good EAP programs will call you later, and they'll say, Ed, you know, you went to see that Dr. Sierra McCauley. What did you think? Did it work? And you say, No, I didn't really connect with him. He seemed kind of uninterested or didn't seem very focused. Whatever it is, they get feedback. So they don't tend to keep referring to people they don't get positive feedback about. So if you're a financial advisor and you're going to an EAP program, they probably have a group of people or a number of people who they've got positive feedback from other financial advisors who've sought their help.
And is it always in person, or can this be done over the phone or through a chat on the internet? Are there other ways?
Well, that's why we're going to develop this coaching forum. It's kind of new to me, Ed, but I realize now that it's done quite often. And I do a lot of phone sessions now. I mean, I have a client in China. I have one in France. I have someone that was transferred to England. We talk. I have a client in Australia. So it can work. I mean, would I prefer to see someone in person? Yeah, if you can meet in person with someone at least to begin with, I think it makes a difference.
Right.
Most of my clients who are in other countries have been here for a time, and we have met, or they've been here on business, and we've met, and then they've gone back to their home country. So they know what I look like. They know I know what they look, and we have we had some rapport in person. And then I think it can work very well on the phone. I think in coaching forums, and that's what we're going to try to develop on the website, I think, you know, we're very hopeful that that will work as well. So it can be done remotely.
Good. And I see your website is up and running. It's thecurseofthecapable.com. And when does the book come out?
The book will come out in the fall. And we're just pretty thrilled that Phil Simms has actually written the foreword. You know, Phil Simms, the NFL analyst.
Right, right.
And Phil certainly knows a lot about high achievers.
Yes, definitely.
Being a Super Bowl MVP and knowing what it takes to maintain that status in life, he was very gracious to write the foreword to the book.
Good. Well, we look forward to that, and maybe we could have you back on or talk to you again as the book release comes closer, and like to find out how your coaching's working with your website here, the group coaching. That looks interesting.
Well, that would be great. I'd love to talk with you again.
Okay. And Dr. Sierra McCauley, author of Performance Addiction and the upcoming The Curse of the Capable, and that'll be available on Amazon. You can find Performance Addiction on Amazon now. And is there a way that listeners could get in touch with you if they wanted to follow up?
Yes. You know, I'm on LinkedIn, and if any of your I imagine many of your listeners are part of LinkedIn, but my email address is Dr. C1@comcast.net.
So Dr. C1@comcast.net.
Yeah, and I can also be reached through my LinkedIn site as well.
Through LinkedIn. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye.
That was Dr. Sierra McCauley, and you're on Advisor Radio. We will be back in about a minute. We're going to talk about core principles, and we will also talk about the winner of the cartoon caption contest. So stick around. We're not finished yet. Advisor Radio. Thank you. We're on Advisor Radio here downtown New York City on the finale of Advisor Fest. And we've had some great guests today. And we're not finished yet. We have some more fun happening, some more informative presentations. We've got two more webinars today coming up at 1 o'clock on Advisor Fest, Staying Positive Month After Month, Breaking Through the Inertia with Jim Rohrbach and Bill Smith. And then at 4 o'clock Eastern Time, How to Structure Your Day During an All-Hands-on-Deck Era with Steve Sandusky. And you can still register for those. It's free. Go to the Horse's Mouth main page, click on Advisor Fest, and look for either one of those presentations, Staying Positive Month After Month and How to Structure Your Day. And both of those seem to come right off of what Dr. Sierra McCauley was talking about, staying positive and also structuring your day and having a plan. So hopefully you'll jump in and sign up for those. I'm here with my colleague and producer, Doug Pierce.
Yep.
And we also have Sean Bailey, Horse's Mouth Editor-in-Chief.
Greetings.
All right. And we did this whole study where we called out to people to ask for their core principles of advisor success. And this is kind of interesting to look at, especially after our last guest, to see what is important and what's been working for financial advisors. And we also will have the winner of the cartoon caption contest during this remaining time that we're together.
Definitely.
So let's look at the core principles suggested by our listeners. These are core principles under prospecting, client care, marketing, public relations, referrals, business planning, and interpersonal communications. So you want to share some of our favorites? We could start.
Yeah, Ed, I think, we call this the Advisor Success Principles Project. And, this is something that we have been discussing for really a long time here at Horse's Mouth about, what are the widely received, wisdom and insight that advisors develop over the years and that the types of things that get passed along from veteran to rookie on a variety of aspects of the business. And so we've used Advisor Fest as an opportunity for us to really take a sort of first pass at this topic. And we asked, we went out almost 7-8 weeks ago and asked the Horse's Mouth members to share with us any variety of core success principles, the sort of, the guide stars they've used in their business on a variety of topics. And we have gotten back some great stuff, and we're going to publish an e-report summary of the core principles for everybody who participated in Advisor Fest. We'll finish up that report in July. But I really kind of view it as sort of phase one of this project, this effort, which has been, we're using the wisdom of the crowds here, right? We're turning to 20,000 advisors and saying, hey, look, those of you who are interested, please participate in this project and share those insights. And that has created for us now a sort of, the boundary of the principles. And I think later this year we'll make some efforts to drill down even deeper with, with each set of principles. But why don't you take one of the ones from the top there, Ed, and we'll share a couple, and just to give our listeners a sense of what it is we're talking about relating to a certain type of core principle.
Sure. One here under client care that I'm interested in, especially in where we're inundated with technology and emails and avoiding personal contact. This one's kind of simple, but it seems to be having more and more traction these days, and that's the strategy of sending a personalized handwritten thank you card or a note to every contact that you come across. And this applies to personal service providers as well as clients, referrals, people who you've met and had a coffee with, and you just develop that as a regular strategy. It feeds into referrals, it feeds into networking, it feeds into the whole Dale Carnegie strategy of getting, you know, other people like you and they want to do business with you. And it's a personal touch that most people don't do, and it can really make a difference. It promotes goodwill, positive attitude.
Absolutely, and I think it was about 3-4 years ago, the most popular article for the year was the 15-minute marketing workout article by Catherine Vesnes, where she introduced to many advisors this notion. I mean, some have been doing it for a long time, but she introduced the idea of blocking out 15 minutes every day to handwrite, you know, thank you notes, postcards, whatever it is, to the people that you're meeting. And, you know, you drop five or six, two, three, four, five a day into the mail, or however, you know, even just two, you know, and you're doing it every day, you get 10 or 15 by the end of the week. And we all know, especially with the advent of email, you go home, you get bills, and you get, you know, direct mail flyers, but hardly anybody gets anything these days that is has a personal touch and has actually been handwritten. Now, my 6-year-old kindergartner got a postcard the other day from both her teachers saying, "Hey, it was a great year, and we really, really enjoyed you know, teaching you." And you know, she was thrilled, and we were too, because you just don't see very much personalized mail in the mail anymore.
Yep.
And so I have to say, this is really an amazing little thing that definitely makes an impact in this day and age.
Well, I've taken that away from Advisor Fest, and I'm having cards, like the one I'm holding up. It's like a postcard size thing, off-white. I'm having them printed up with my name on it and matching envelopes.
Excellent.
I'm going to try the strategy myself, partially also because, you know, I make my kids write thank yous all the time. Then I realize, you know, I want them to see someone does something for me. How hard is it just to jot a quick note
Sure.
and drop it in the mail? And I want to try that for myself and see how that affects
things. Yeah, I highly recommend it.
Oh.
Good, good. So that's a client care. That's an example of a client care core principle. You want to share one or two other client care ones before we go on?
Oh, okay. Let's see. I would say, let's see, this one is take the time to really know your clients, your clients, their family, their fears, dreams, and what makes them tick.
Hmm.
Be honest, forthcoming, and clear. Never assume and always create an atmosphere of trust. If you can show this to your clients, that through good times and bad times, you're there for them, they'll stay with you. You won't keep them all, but if you conduct your business and client affairs with their best welfare in mind and a clear conscience, you will be satisfied, fulfilled, and sleep well at night. And that's from Richard.
Yeah, that's a great one too, because I recall an article that we did in the past that was titled something to the effect of, you know, the hundreds of warm prospects right under your nose. And the warm prospects are, you know, the sons and daughter, the adult sons and daughters of your elderly clients. Because listen, you know, I mean, no one. My great aunt's 103 years old. She keeps going, but you know, we all don't get to 103. And at some point, your elderly clients are going to disappear from the scene. And if you've worked with them properly, they've got good estate planning. And what you really want is for the assets to stay with your business. You know the investments. You know the you know the person. You know, hopefully, the family as well. But what happens all too often is that advisors have not done anything to cultivate a relationship with the adult family members of their elderly clients. And so, you know, then the client passes, and a few months later the ACAT form comes in, and there it goes. And, you know, I mean, who wants to do business that way anyway? It's like, as we've said time and time again, if you as an advisor feel that you truly have real value to add, and I believe that you do, you want to be able to be sure that you're sharing that with as many people as possible. The most light, you know, some of the warmest people would be the adult children of your clients. Now, I know there's other things that get mixed in there. In some families, you know, the adult children are still infantilized and the parents have never even discussed finances with their kids. They're still treating them like they're 12-year-olds. But there's that dynamic in there, so I know that not every single advisor can have a great potential relationship with every single family member of the adult, of the elderly adult client. But the idea of knowing your client's family and the children, it's crucial, because you're really trying to connect. You want to connect with your clients. You want to have a three-dimensional understanding of who they are, and that's why it's another reason we're really emphasizing client events these days as a way for advisors to connect and reconnect with their clients. And that is that it adds, when you have a personal connection with your clients, it adds dimensionality to the relationship. It's not just the portfolio and the monthly statement and the review meeting. It's a lot, it has more depth to it.
Yeah, and another one here that was good is, this is pretty succinct. Every client is your own aged mother who is relying on you to keep her secure in her golden years.
Yeah, well, there you go. It's really all the same, the same the same principles at work there, I think.
Yep.
To some degree.
Jumping over to prospecting, here's an interesting one. With the spirit of John Madden in your heart, remember that our business is a contact sport. So pick up the phone and contact those clients and prospects. The more challenging the environment, the more important the contact principle becomes. From Michael.
Well, that's a good one. You've got to bring enthusiasm to the business. And when I think of John Madden, I think about the guy practically coming through the TV screen at you. Bringing that kind of enthusiasm to your business is crucial, especially when you've gone through a down or rough period here. And we've been talking about cold calling here. I had Shuang Breen on earlier today, and she did a great presentation. Earlier in Advisor Fest, and we know that many advisors in this business got their start on the phones, and now we're seeing there's a good many who are mid-career or later and are suddenly feeling like they need to be prospecting again and willing to go back to the phones and work the phones to develop more prospects. So again, bringing John Madden like enthusiasm to your job, to the game of prospecting. That's a contact sport, whether it's on the phones or whether you're getting out there and meeting people or whether you're doing, as we've advised in one of our very popular prospecting articles, about driving to a town 25 miles away and like a raiding party into some other advisor's territory. Go into that small town, walk the streets, meet the business owners, make it, declare that it's part of your territory, and start to go out there on a regular basis and make contacts, cultivate people, do things, so that John Madden enthusiasm, when it comes to prospecting, it's right on. I'm totally with it.
We actually had, when Shuang Breen was with us earlier, we had a caller named Frank who was about ready to make his first cold call in 20 years.
Right?
Yeah, wow. Well, there you go.
Just getting back into it, so yeah.
Right. Well, you need some little John Madden enthusiasm, I guess.
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one.
Here's another one. Tell your prospects that you live by three principles in managing their portfolios. Number one, achieve the best possible return based on the risk they're willing to accept. Number two, keep the taxes to a minimum. Number three, make sure they sleep at night. If any of these fail to be followed, you're not doing your job.
I think that that is a fabulous core set of core principles there, because they're powerful, they're meaningful, they're succinct. They address the concerns that I think the average the average investor and client has. And that's a great one.
You're on Advisor Radio, and we're talking about core principles submitted by you, the listeners, and we're still gathering them. You can submit them on the Horse's Mouth site, and you can call us up if you want to share core principles that work for you. 347-215-7291, 347-215-7291, and press 1, and we'll get you on the line. Here's one from Bob. Don't waste your efforts pursuing new clients or retaining existing clients that aren't a reflection of your business model. The best clients and prospects are a reflection of who you are, not who you want to be. Life is too short to waste time with these time wasters.
Hmm.
What do you think of that?
That's an interesting one. You know, when we talk about developing a niche, and the idea of developing a niche requires that you develop an ideal client profile. And something we hear from advisors a lot is, but what if somebody comes through the door and they don't fit my niche, but they've got a, you know, they've got a nice investment account that needs work. Maybe they're coming from another advisor. Maybe they've just come into some money. They don't fit your profile. They say, well, I can't, you know, I can't turn that person down. And I have to say, I can't blame them for not wanting to turn them down. And what we say normally in the context of a niche is, okay, you're pursuing your niche. You have someone else come through the door, and they don't fit your ideal client profile. We normally say, you know, depending upon where you are in the growth of your business, you can accept them, and it's still not violating the fact that you're pursuing a niche. But now in this context, this person is saying the opposite, really. He's saying don't align yourself with people that aren't in sync with the kind of ideal client you're looking for.
And also, client book segmentation is also a key thing that we've found. You know, splitting your book into to A, B, C clients so that you can really dole out your service in ways that are most beneficial to you.
Well, I think we established with the niche work that's been done that it's certainly okay to take people, you know, outside of your niche. As Sean said, I think perhaps what Bob is meaning here is you sort of know in your heart of who you want to work with and why, and really let that guide you rather than what other people think you should be doing or the people that they think you should be working with. I think that's
right.
Maybe what he means.
Yeah, right.
Here's a person that writes, the slogan I use to define the focus and mission of my company is the financial advisor who sits on the same side of the table as his clients. I want my clients to understand clearly that I know that the success of my firm is directly tied to their financial success. By sitting alongside them, I'm able to talk with them and not talk down to them. I am transitioning my practice to a fee-based model to further illustrate this. If their investments don't grow, then the revenues of my firm won't grow. I believe that this approach leads to a more intimate relationship with these clients. Reinforcing their trust in me is of great importance during these difficult times. That's J. Michael.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, well, certainly the idea of sitting on the same side of the table as your client has been, a standard part of the communication that goes on in the conversation where you're transitioning a client from commissions to fees. And, you know, it particularly sounded good when the markets were going up. And for advisors who have been following that approach, they definitely have experienced the downside of it as well in the last year, so probably for the first time in a long time. So, you know, sounds pretty good. Makes sense to me.
And here's one that you must maintain balance between your personal life and your business life, ensuring that you keep every area of your life in the proper order. And that kind of goes back to what we just spoke to in the past hour with our guest. It is a constant challenge to balance work with home, but if you don't do it, you're ultimately...
You burn out. And, of course, it's been... that's one of the reasons that we decided to do Advisor Fest was that, when the market cracked back in the middle of September last year, it became all hands on deck, and it was all hands on deck right through the fall, and and the market started recovering somewhat through December and January, and then all hell broke loose again in February, and the market went way down into March a little bit, By now, even though the market has come back again, from the typical investor out there is feeling, very beaten up, and it has been total all hands on deck for advisors. But you cannot sustain that. And the reason we did Advisor Fest was to encourage people to sort of take some time out now, and maybe over the coming weeks now to sort of sit back and reflect upon the principles and topics we've covered here during Advisor Fest to sort of rethink your business. We've heard from so many different people. The situation has changed. Now, Joe Lucas was talking about how, you know, clients definitely, their decision-making process has definitely been, you know, this is a big blowback, and everybody's been majorly hurt by it. And he was suggesting, you know, re-benchmarking with your clients. But the point is that you can't do all hands on deck for 10, 11, 12 straight months. I mean, you know, it'll kill you. And that's a great principle. You've got to get away from the office. You've got to get out, do some things that are good for you that don't have anything to do with being an advisor, don't have anything to do with, you know, reading about what, you know, Warren Buffett may think now or Noriel Roubini may think now or whomever. And, you know, go to the ocean. Go for a walk in the woods. Take a weekend in the mountains. Do whatever it is that you enjoy to do that has nothing to do with being an advisor. You've got to have balance in your life, you know. And it's so easy to give up on that sort of thing, especially when you're in a crisis. But as soon as possible, it's important for people to, you know, get back to the exercise, get back to having a, you know, a fuller, more rounded life. It's good for you. It's good for your clients. It's good for your creativity, your insight. I mean, that's definitely.
Yeah, that's an area I think we'll be exploring as we're going forward and talking to advisors who have figured out a way to make this work, you know, and how they lay out a strategy.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, because there's so many just competing areas that just go for your time that it's getting tougher and tougher.
And of course, at 1 o'clock, you're moderating a session on motivation. So
yes,
you know, I think motivation is something that can sort of be pushed to the side when people are in a crisis period where they're just, you know, day in and day out servicing clients and their to-do list is so big that the kinds of things that they normally do to recharge their motivation get pushed to the side. So
good.
That's a great one.
All right. We'll do a couple more, then we'll do the winner of the cartoon cat.
Yeah, okay, we'll see what that's going to be fun. We're going to call up the winner and see what happens. So
okay.
The first for Advisor Radio.
This person has one simple core principle. Never leave the office until the last call is returned.
It's probably a good one. Because, now, I'm sure it was maybe a little more challenging in the fall when all of a sudden, you know, all 200 clients were calling in a period of 5 days and you had, you know, 20 or 30 callbacks because any one of those calls could go on for a half an hour. I know that we hear from clients a lot, the whole communication thing, you know, oh, he doesn't return my call, or it takes forever for him to return the call, whatever. So the idea that you are calling somebody back on the day that they make the call to you, even if it's just to say, I got your call, I understand the question, let me do a little research and get back to you, you know, that works. People understand that. But what they don't understand is placing the call and not hearing from the advisor, because then there's just that gap, and just gives the client more time to dwell on why am I not hearing back from him, and, you know, start to feel slighted, and all these things build up, and then things build up in the advisor's mind too. It's like, oh God, I didn't call that person back. It's been 2 days now. What am I going to do? You get yourself all wrapped up in a pretzel, then it becomes a third day, and then it's the weekend, and then, you know, it falls off the radar. That sounds like a great policy to make sure that you get back to people same day.
And another succinct one, I never invest in or recommend anything I don't understand.
Well, you know, I think that's, what can you say? It goes without, it ought to go without saying, and I hope that people aren't putting their clients in things they don't understand. And, you know, I mean, that's certainly, we have seen a growing sophistication and complexity to investment products. And, you know, there's a lot of structured products out there, there's derivatives, and there's all these things. And, I hope the advisor understands it, for sure.
Another one for you. Having worked in the financial services industry and having provided financial advice to thousands of advisors and to clients, My single best idea is to take notes and use notes. It makes one brilliant.
Yeah, well.
Take notes and use notes.
You know, I think we saw some other core principles. I think somebody toward the very end actually recommended recording client conversations, and then I imagine he gets a transcription of them. I'm not sure, and I don't know what the compliance issues are about that, but absolutely. I mean, the note, you know, thorough note-taking has got to be totally critical, because you sit down, client and advisor sit down, and in 45 or 50 minutes, you know, especially if it's like, you know, you're checking in once a quarter with them, or maybe this is even the annual thing, it's like a lot of things can be covered in 45 or 50 minutes. You know, you could talk about college planning, you could talk about estate planning, you could talk about insurance, you could talk about, you know, freeing up some cash for some real estate investment or whatever, not to mention just all the nitty-gritty about the portfolio, you know, about the actual investments in the portfolio. There's a lot of stuff there. And so as taking detailed notes, it's got to be, you know, it's got to be a core principle. And somebody who's not a good note taker, you know, needs to figure out how to overcome that situation, whether it means getting your assistant in there who is a good note taker, or possibly recording it as somebody has suggested. But clearly, you know, it's key.
How about this one? I have reached a point of clarity with regard to the stock market surrounding this reality. The only thing that matters in investing is price. Without a strategy to take advantage of pricing trends, investors are exposed to open-ended free fall when stock prices fall, and are equally unable to determine when prices have peaked in any consistent manner, whether we are referring to indexes or mutual funds. Buy and hold has meant buy and lose for the past 10 years. That's Timothy.
Yeah, I think that that's a very under the investment umbrella as far as core principles go. You know, I'm always very interested to hear, you know, what advisors think if, you know, someone walks in with $1 million today. What are you going to do? And, you know, some advisors are very, very careful about feathering. You know, say, okay, we agree, we have a conversation, we do the whole, you know, all the work together, figure out what your risk tolerance is and all that sort of stuff, and this is what we're going to do. And but then they feather the money into the market over the next 60 or 90 days. They don't all plunk it down at once and then see the market go south. On the other hand, of course, you do. You know, the market may go up as well. But to have a conversation with the client that, all right, these are the kinds of investments we want to get into. This is the particular stock or fund, but we think it's maybe overbought or overbought at this point in time, so we want to wait till it comes back down into a range that makes more sense, and then we'll get in. And then likewise, to have some idea, especially in this day and age, you know, to have some idea of the upside potential of the investment and what you're going to do, what you're going to do to get out at a certain price. And also, I think people are much more interested now in downside protection. You know, it's like, all right, they can agree with the advisor. You know, this is what we want to do. We're going to go after this. You know, we're going to buy this ETF in this area. You know, if suddenly there is a disaster or some sort of international incident that affects the underlying fundamentals of that ETF sector or something, and the whole thing is going to, you know, drop 5%, 10%, 20% or whatever, it's like, you know, you don't want to sit there and take that. You want to know in advance that maybe we're going to say, okay, we're getting this ETF and we're going to put, you know, an 8% trailing stop on it or whatever. So if everything does, you know, go crazy tomorrow, yeah, maybe we're going to get out. I don't know, but it's that seems like a good one to me. I would certainly appreciate that in my advisor.
Yeah. How about this one from business planning? Create a mission statement for your business that has goals and a deadline. This is success principle numero uno. Without it, you might as well fold up your tent.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think he's absolutely right. You have got to have absolute specific goals, and I think we see that all the time. People, you know, they confuse a mission statement and their goals with something broad that's meant to be consumed by clients and prospects, and it's not highly specific, and it's not time-oriented. So, I think it's a great one. You want to be able to say that by December, we are going to have a new client event strategy in place, and we're going to be holding events small private dinners with our top clients once a month, you know, starting, you know, by this fall. That's a very specific goal with a time date on it. And those are the kinds of things where there's accountability involved. And, and what's the point of having a plan if you don't have specific goals and then you can't come back and say, okay, well, did I do it or did I not do it? And if I didn't do it, why? And when you understand why, you make the adjustments, you adjust a very specific goal, and you keep going. And that's the sort of the input and output that runs the business. So.
Yeah, and Steve adds on that with his core principle. If you find some of your principles were wrong, admit it and adapt.
Yeah, well,
right.
But we definitely see a lot of that. We've done an investment philosophy survey recently, and everybody knows, you hear that a lot of people got into this business trained by large firms, and they were encouraged to be on the same table with the client, sort of act as the leader or the quarterback. We're going to hire these separately managed accounts, and we'll see how it goes, and we'll fire the managers if they don't perform, and if they do perform, you know, that's great. I think that that principle definitely makes sense. Yeah.
That would be a good question to run past Dr. Arthur. The whole idea of why people will continue to do things even when they may question whether or not it's working.
Yeah,
you're stuck
right.
to your belief.
Right.
There are a lot of studies about that people will stick to something.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And we can see so many. There's a lot of people. You know, a lot of advisors in the business who were into sort of buy and hold, and now there's just a lot of data over the last 10 years where the market is now and where it was 10 years ago and what has gone up and not gone up. And, it's disheartening to realize that strategy you have adhered to for a long time and you've professed to your clients really is wrong. But I'll tell you what, you'll make a big impression with your clients when you're able to step forward and say, look, and this is what clients are hiring advisors for anyway. It's like, okay, you're going on the best evidence. You're pursuing the best strategy that's available, and this is what we've all settled on. I understand you've explained it to me, the client, and we're going to do it. It's gone on for a while now, and it's not working. So I respect you as a professional if you're coming back to me and saying, look, this isn't working. I have some new approaches that I think are going to work. I've spent a lot of time researching this, thinking about it, and here's what I'm recommending. That's the kind of leadership that I want from my advisor. It's like, it's like if you go to a doctor, suppose you've got, an illness, and he comes up with a course of action, and the course of action isn't working. You want him to just, dig his heels in and keep doing it. It's like, okay, well, let's look at some alternative therapies. What else works? What else could it be? Try something else. I mean, that's the kind of leadership that I think clients want. I think a lot of smart advisors are doing that now, too.
Good. All right. Should we transition to the cartoon caption?
Well, I think that's a good idea. Doug,
all right.
we have a winner now.
Yes.
We have a winner for the cartoon caption. And in case somebody's listening and they haven't had a chance to see the cartoon, this is radio, so you always need to use your imagination in radio. but the cartoon is an advisor sitting at a table, and I'm sitting at his desk, and across the desk clear what seems to be a couple, a client couple there. And then to the immediate left of the advisor is a pirate. So we have a winner, and let's read all three captions, okay? So one caption was, before our analyst would recommend buying Long John Silver, he insisted on doing his due diligence. And that came from Larry Elk in Sarasota, Florida. Larry finished third there, but that was a great contribution.
All right.
The next one was from Jim Unigard in Hays, Kansas. And Jim's caption was, "Oh, he's part of the mortgage bailout stimulus package. If you miss a payment this time, one of you will be kidnapped and held for ransom."
Good one.
Yeah, it's a good one, good one. And our winner, the winning caption is this: "We've been looking for a non-correlated asset manager for some time now." And the winner is Jesse Walden from Oakland, California. And all three of those people, Jim, Jesse, and Elkin, and Larry, will receive a brand new when it comes out in July. Our Secrets of Successful Client Events, the complete guide to fun, easy, low-stress ways to connect with the people who keep you in business.
All right.
Yeah, so we're going to do, this is a first for Advisor Radio. Our producer, Doug Pierce, we have the ability to dial out, and we're just going to take a crack at it and see if there's some chance that we can get Jesse Walden on the phone and congratulate him. So, Doug, we may hear some technical, we may have the phone ringing or whatever, but just take it away, Doug. Let's see what happens here.
All right, here we go.
Should be fun.
But by the way, Doug, will they hear if someone answers here in a second?
Yeah, hello, everybody.
All right, so I'll say hello.
Okay.
Good morning, Jesse Walden's office. This is Britton.
Hi, Britton. My name is Sean Bailey. I'm the editor-in-chief at Horse's Mouth, and I'm trying to reach Jesse.
He's got someone in his office right now. Can I have him call you back? Is there anything I can help you with?
Well, we're calling Jesse to congratulate him because we've been having something here at Horse's Mouth called Advisor Fest. It's been going on for a little more than a week now. And we had an advisor cartoon caption contest. And Jesse entered a caption in the contest. It was one of the three finalists, and he actually is the winner. He is the funniest advisor that we know, at least for this week. And we're actually live on Advisor Radio. Yeah, for this week. So we're actually live on Advisor Radio right now, and thought, well, we've never used this program to call somebody out, but we thought, oh, we'll try and get Jesse on the phone and congratulate.
Can I have your name one more time?
Yes, Sean Bailey.
Sean. Okay. Sean, can you hold on for one
second?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Yep.
Let's see if we get him.
Yeah, we'll see, you know.
We'll see if he was really in a client meeting.
Yeah.
Well, Jesse is in Oakland, California, so it's only 9:30 in the morning out there. I'm not sure I would interrupt my client meeting to take a call for the cartoon caption contest, but on the other hand, it could... everybody could get a little chuckle out of it, so we'll see.
Sean Green would be proud of how you kind of worked through the gatekeeper there.
I think there you go. So we're on some Muzak here at Advisor Radio.
Well, coming up at 1 o'clock Eastern Time, staying positive month after month, breaking through the inertia with Jim Rohrbach and Bill Smith. And I'll be moderating that. You can register.
Good morning, it's Jesse Wardell. Hello.
Jesse, this is Sean Bailey, editor-in-chief at Horse's Mouth. How are you?
I'm doing great, Sean. How are you?
We're doing great, and congratulations. You are actually live on Advisor Radio right now, I want you to know.
Oh, yay for me. Okay. Listen,
and,
you buy low, sell high, and, you know, and make sure that the client can sleep at night.
Well,
what
there
you
go. Well, Jesse, you're the winner of our cartoon caption contest. I don't know if you even saw that you were your caption. We've been looking with the pirate standing there next to the advisor and the clients, and your caption was, "We've been looking for a non-correlated asset manager for some time now," and you were one of three finalists. We've had more than 1,000 people vote on it. We've had 1,084 people vote on it, and. You're the winner, so we're calling to say congratulations and let you know that you have won, coming in July to your office, a copy of our new Action Research Report, Secrets of Successful Client Events, the complete guide to fun, easy, low-stress ways to connect with people who keep you in business. So, Jesse, we just wanted to call and give you that news, and I appreciate the fact that you could take a call while you're in a client meeting there, and we know it's just 9:30 in the morning out there, but We wanted to say thank you for participating. And
hey, it's my pleasure, and I want to tell you guys, I think that, is, you know, even though I'm not paid to tell you this, I think you guys are doing a great job, and this Advisor Fest is a wonderful thing to do.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that a lot, and we'll say goodbye for now and let you get back to your clients, and congratulate you once again for an insightful and funny caption for the cartoon contest. Yes.
Well, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it, and you guys have a wonderful day.
Okay, you take care.
Bye now.
Thanks. All right. On that note, we're going to wrap up Advisor
Radio. One more thing I want to say. So, yes, we're wrapping up Advisor Radio here. We've got another event at 1 o'clock and another at 4 o'clock, and that's it for the whole week. But I want to say thank you to you, Ed Klink, and Doug Pierce. You guys have kept Advisor Radio going 2 to 3 hours a day since last Wednesday. You've done an absolutely fabulous job. This is something new for Horse's Mouth Advisor Radio. We started it a couple weeks before Advisor Fest just to get comfortable with the technology, and here we are the very last day using our ability to call out to other people, which is fun as well. And so I appreciate everything you guys have done. You've done a fabulous, fabulous job. Thank you. And I know we've had thousands of people listen to the program. And after Advisor Fest is over, we're going to sit down and figure out how to continue Advisor Radio. We're going to look for making it more of more call-in shows. Maybe we'll fashion it so we get some more debate going on and get people to call in with their questions. And it's got a lot of potential, and you've done a great job of bringing that to the Advisor Fest participants and the Horse's Mouth members. So
thanks.
I thank both of you.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for everyone for listening. And you can catch, we got some fun lined up today at 1 o'clock, Staying Positive Month After Month, Breaking Through the Inertia with Jim Rohrbach and Bill Smith. That's what I've got to run now and get ready to moderate, but I hope you join it. If you haven't had a chance to register, go to the Horse's Mouth page, click on Advisor Fest, get in on that. We're going to have fun. Jim Rohrbach and Bill Smith are two fantastic guys with a lot of good information. And then at 4 o'clock, how to structure your day during an all-hands-on-deck era. What a great way to wrap up your week, wrap up Advisor Fest, and check that out. That's at 4 o'clock with Steve Sandusky. It's worth it. You can register for either one or both of them, and you can go do that now. I want to thank everyone for listening. Today's show on Advisor Radio is brought to you by Vanguard. Vanguard's low-cost ETFs can form a strong foundation to help you meet your clients' goals. And hope everyone has a fantastic weekend. And we'll catch you next time on Advisor Radio. What do you say, Doug? Time to grab a quick bite for the next show?
A very quick bite for you. We'll be right back.
This Horse's Mouth presentation is offered specifically for financial advisors and may not be reproduced, broadcast, or distributed without permission from Horse's Mouth. Unauthorized use, reproduction, or distribution of this material is a violation of federal law and punishable by civil and criminal penalty.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Advisor Radio, broadcasting from Horse's Mouth headquarters in downtown New York City. I'm Horse's Mouth senior editor, Ed Klink. We're here on the finale of Advisor Fest 2009. This morning, we'll be speaking with Sean Green on how to work the phone.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.